coming to you from the City of the Weird. Exploring topics from the esoteric and unexplored to dimensions unknown. Shining a light of truth on the darkest corners of our reality. Welcome to the Curious Realm. Well, hello, everybody, and welcome to the official 100th episode of The Curious Realm. Chris Jordan here, your host, coming to you in a pre-recorded fashion, though I am here in town off the road. I am out trick-or-treating with my son, as a proper father should on Halloween. We are out begging people for candy and trying to scare the bejesus out of them with costumes. Halloween is one of my favorite times of the year. It is a beautiful thinning of the veil between our world and the next. And that is a thought process that has existed for millennia across mankind, across numerous cultures. Tonight, we will be exploring some of the other side. We will be exploring some of the topics of occult. We will be exploring some of the topics of exorcism in our next segment with our good friend, Father James Cloud, exorcist. And in this segment, we are discussing the world of demon seeding, the idea of Nephilim and Nephilim, like fallen angels who have been around and are still around and are quite literally feeding off of us, not only energetically, but through our souls and actively taking over bodies. It's a phenomenal topic, and it is the work of our good friend, Nathaniel Gillis. Welcome back to the show. How are you doing, bud?
Doing great, sir, and it's wonderful to be with you on this amazing anniversary. You know, you're one of my favorite hosts.
Thank you.
One of my favorite shows, and more than that, you're a good friend, and it's just an honor to be with you and yours.
Well, same, man. I always love our conversations on and off air, and I have been, since I first found you, and I want to say it may have been, was it Michelle Fried that connected us first?
Yes, the amazing Michelle, absolutely.
Thank you, Michelle. I now work with Michelle with my music, all kinds of things. She has connected me with so many guests who we have become fast friends with on and off air, and you are one of them, man. I love watching your work. I have loved watching your work develop over the last many years, and to see you going on shows like Forbidden Knowledge with Billy Carson, all kinds of things. It is great to see you getting this work out to a larger audience. I think it is one that I think a lot of people misunderstand in a lot of ways. There are a lot of folks out there nowadays, Nathaniel, that claim the title demonologist, and I think misplacingly so. There are a huge field of study when it comes to this. Let's get into how you first came to the world of demonology and studying demons and how they interact with humanity, man.
Yeah, so I grew up in the evangelical movement. And during that time of going to my local church, I was experiencing a malevolent haunting in my own house. The entity that I met at the opening house before my family purchased it manifested as the apparition of a little girl. And it was from that moment we moved in, and then that being mutated. And that's when I realized that this was not a little girl at all. You know, I could not locate her in the neighborhood. She belonged to none of the neighbors. And it wasn't the little girl at all. It was just a being that was trying to gain my trust and to manipulate my innocence as a child. But that was my first encounter with the phenomenon. And like I said before, it wasn't a little girl. It changed. And so it was a shadow figure sometimes. Sometimes it would displace its weight in the living room wooden floor. I mean, it would just walk at nighttime. I could hear it. It would keep me up. And it's so funny because not too long ago, I was talking to my mom, and my mom said, "Don't you remember when you told me that there was a witch that had walked into your room?" And I had forgotten completely about that. I forgot all about it. And I said, "No, tell me more about that." She goes, "Yes." She said, "You ran into our room one night screaming because there was this really decrepit, almost like a shadow figurey witch."
Oh, wow.
That had just kind of slipped into your room and watched you from the corner. I had forgotten all about it. Like, I promise you, Christopher, I had no idea. Wow. And so, yeah, so that house was full of activity. But that was my first encounter, or even confrontation, if you wish, with the phenomenon we're going to be discussing today. And that's really what got me into this field and to where I'm at in my research.
Now, how old were you when that experience happened?
I was about 9 when that particular manifestation occurred. I was 8 when we moved in.
Wow. I remember I was probably about 4 years old, the first experience that I recall having. And we lived in a small little trailer house in Crosby, Texas. This is literally my only memory of that trailer house, Nathaniel. Across the back patio was our neighbor that I would go pick chicken eggs with, things like that, in her yard. And we had a swing set in between our yards. I remember looking out the window one day and seeing a dark figure at the swing set. What I have to this day said was the devil. That is what it appeared like to me. It looked to me like what was on the side of the can of deviled ham. It was a shadowy figure. It had horns, and it was beckoning to me to come outside. That was my first experience ever. And I vividly remember that. I remember the shock of fear that was in my body and being frozen. I don't remember anything after that. I don't know if I went outside, cannot recall anything else, but it lived vividly in my head. And it's one of those that I tell guests, I tell people all the time, never. The fact that your parents didn't dismiss you is a beautiful thing, Nathaniel. Never right. dismiss what a child comes and tells you like that. Never dismiss it.
It was important that they were there for me. And to this day, I'll just be honest. I mean, there's no point in hiding it at this juncture. Yeah. I mean, look, there are times when people can call me whatever they want, but I'll sleep with a little light on, and I'll turn Frasier on to where I feel like I'm not alone. And I think that was, you know, that's the side effect of the trauma I experienced as a child when everybody else is asleep, but something was present with but absent from me at the same time. It's there. I can still remember feeling watched by the entity, like there were eyes somewhere in the darkness. But what really was instrumental about that experience was I realized that the phenomenon can wear masks. It's not all love and light. And more than that, that there's a high measure of deception being employed. And when I figured it all out, I'm like, okay, this is not a little girl. Then what was it? And why would it know the human condition of a young boy to realize, okay, what do I have to turn into to gain his trust?
You know, it's interesting, Nathaniel, because that is a topic that before our conversation on air, we were discussing the concept of, air quotes here, folks, woo, right. in communities, and be it UFO, be it this, folks, is the idea of there is a physical manifestation of Sasquatch, but then there are the folks that are me and my nana. We feed them hot dogs from our back door and we watch them. You know, that's the woo, and the idea that now, and I don't doubt anybody's experience ever, 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 but there are two camps in a lot of these fields, be it
right.
Cryptozoology, be it ufology, and a lot of people are upset that some of the woo has crept into things like MUFON. you know, but it's there, and it's there in all of them, even in your demonologic work, even in the field of paranormal, there is a woo aspect to it. And some of that can be seen in folks walking around trying to talk to spirits to a lot of old school paranormal investigators, that would be considered woo.
Yeah.
Like, no offense, everybody, but if you're walking around trying to communicate with the ghost and trying to make it do something, you aren't trying to, at that point, you have subtracted the scientific point of studying the phenomenon in its natural state, and you are trying to poke and prod the phenomena into action. That is woo.
Yeah.
That's woo. It's not
the
science.
Act of provocation.
Yeah, the act and of you provocation is not science. Science is observation in its natural state. So, like, it's weird, but you know, there are two camps in every one of these fields, and on occasion they commingle well. On occasion, on occasion they don't. You know, and I am of the mind, especially when it comes to demonology, buddy, they can't be no woo.
Right.
There can't be no woo. You can't be playing with them. They play by a different set of rules, man. They were given a totally different set of rules. And the last directive given, literally the last directive given, was in Job. You can't kill him. That's the only rule. That's the only rule they got, is you can't kill them. You could do anything you want. You can torture them. You can torment them. You can take away their riches. You can destroy their homes and families, but you can't kill them. That's the only rule.
Yep, you're exactly right. And I'll tell you what, it's so funny because we were talking about some of this, you know, backstage, right?
Yeah.
Backstage.
And, in the green room.
In the green room, right? Rock on now. yeah, you're right. And there are two camps, especially here within the States. There are people that, and I never suggested to do this in an investigation, but, you know, the rite of provocation, and because you don't know what you're poking. You have no idea. Yeah. Absolutely no idea. I can remember a case study in, I think it was the 11th century, when a 16-year-old boy was picking apples with his father, and they're in this orchard that they owned, or they purchased off an old family anyways. And he's picking apples with his father, and his father goes, okay, I'm going to go over here to another area of the orchard, and I'm going to be picking apples. He goes, we'll meet up for lunch here in a couple hours. He goes, okay. Well, the father comes back to the son later on, and the son looks disheveled. His clothes are ripped. There's bruises on his body. And he is now possessed by an entity. And when he took his son to the exorcist, he's interrogating this entity that was within the boy. They asked him, who are you? And the entity gave them his name. I'm so-and-so. Okay. And now it's so interesting. They're looking for victimology at this point. Why would you choose this victim? Why would you choose him over the father? He said, because in my life, I would assault people. And that's putting it, you know, PG. And he said that it was in this same orchard many, many, many years ago, underneath that same tree, that I assaulted my very first victim. And this kid, boy, wandered into that orchard underneath that tree, not even realizing that there was a being present that was stalking his own crime scenes. So the rite of provocation is definitely not a good idea, because we don't have the ability to quantify what kind of threat they represent to our species. Yeah. And poking the bear, again, you can even look at Ed Lorraine Warren's case study, you know, at Harrisville, Rhode Island. They tried to poke the bear. It almost killed them all.
Yeah.
Not a good idea.
Well, and, you know, any good exorcist will tell you that's just it. It is a long, long road to the world of exorcism. Mm-hmm. Nowadays, we have psychological treatment, things like that they go through first. But the idea that these things are able to guise themselves. Let's get into that real quick, Nathaniel.
Yeah, absolutely. So the phenomenon does have the ability to wear masks, and I am of the opinion and the theory that the phenomenon has been with us since the dawn of written history, possibly, probably even before that. And so when we are dealing with this particular phenomenon, we must realize that it has evolved according to our awareness of it. And that's why when people are asking, especially in just the paranormal field entirely, not just ufology or hauntology or demonology, but, you know, people say, well, you know, this is a new phenomenon. It's not a new phenomenon. And I think the reason that many researchers want it to be a new phenomenon is because they don't want to include negative case studies in history into their field of research. If it's a new phenomenon, it has a new origin. Therefore, I'm not responsible for researching anything in biblical antiquity or any religious text in Mesopotamia, right? I could just focus sure. on abduction accounts. Well, that's not, in my opinion, this is my where I'm coming from. That's not the way to research, at least. I think that the phenomenon, again, has been manifesting in different masks. And it's because of that that we cannot discount the field of demonology. Demonology has case studies for millennia that give us insights into their sexual pathology, their victimology, sure. and their behavioral pathology, and what they do, why they do it, and how they're doing it. And so that's really what I've been trying to bring to the field is, okay, you know, trying to link demonology with ufology. And it's, you know, some people hate it. I don't care. It doesn't matter to me. Other people love it.
I find them hand in hand. And yeah. more and more, 2 points here with that. Number one, the idea of masking and woo. We have right. brought up numerous times on this show with numerous people. Jason McLean, hey, how you doing, bud? Mm-hmm. I mean, Nick Redfern, so many. The idea that right. I firmly believe in the hominid known as Sasquatch. I believe that there is an undiscovered hominid species in North America and across the globe. Fully believe it. I also believe that there is something else. That there is something else, whether we're talking alien thought form, spiritual thought form, what have you, that is able to use the tropes in our mind for safety. Much like the 100%. Much like the creature was able to know that you would be comfortable with a little girl. Had 100%. had you seen that being in its true form? Even me with devil, whatever it was, like, hey, it saw it, like I said, I saw what I saw on the side of a can of meat. That's what I saw. It was familiar to me. Something that wouldn't frighten me, but may come to a beckon because you've seen a commercial and it was cute with the little devil walking around. Ha ha, eat some meat, you know? But the familiarity is what it's tapping into. And the idea that it has a trope that, or trope sensor rather, using the tropes in our mind that we're comfortable with to gain access. And, yes, and to gain access specifically to our consent. None of this can happen without our consent. We have to consent into that system. Even Job consented into the system.
Absolutely. It's
Job
strange,
accepted
but
the
it's
challenge
true.
By saying, oh, no. Sorry, my man. This is not the work of a devil. I love my God. He's doing great for me. He consented to the challenge at that point. And it all has to do with our consent. And the question is, how do we open the door? If a vampire pops up, do you open the door? No, you know not to open. You know when something knocks at your third story window, not to open it. You know.
Absolutely.
But if it pops up and it looks like a friend that you haven't seen in years, and then disappears again, that's a different story.
It's a different story, and the way that they have hacked our belief system inspires a thought in me that I've been wrestling with for the last 6 months.
Go for it.
If they are stepping into roles, who gave them the roles? You know, have they created entire religions in which to hide behind to prop up their own religious figures so that later on they could manifest as those religious figures to deceive us? Now, this gets back into this whole idea of role playing. I know that's heavy because people are like, what? You got to think about it.
That's heavy and heady.
Come back.
That's heady.
Absolutely. And so we're looking at, you know, the ways that they've manipulated our species. It's deeply troubling. I mean, in demonology, there was a text that was written in Prague, and they were talking about their demons and some of the manifestations they were documenting. And they encountered a specific blueprint of demonology that's troubling, even more troubling than what a lot of demonologists would like to entertain. Number one, that demons know when people will die, how they will die, what kind of clothes they will die in. And this is documented throughout history. And so when you look at that knowledge base, then you have an idea of how and why they would often manifest as deceased loved ones, because mm-hmm. they know, right? They know. And this gets back into the interconnectivities between ufology and demonology, because we've allegedly had aliens manifest as deceased loved ones in order to garner consent to in their victims. And so it's not just the information base that this phenomenon is all operating off of, but it's their willingness to use the information they have to manipulate us. You know, oh, okay, I'm Deirdre and Edna. I said this all week on shows, but yeah, I'm Deirdre and Edna, or I'm Uncle Bobby. And so what we're realizing in the field now, at least what we're realizing is that there has to be a way to test them. And, you know, we've had too many cases where psychics believe they're being guided by a being or by a deceased loved one. And then years later, they realize that the being was playing the long game and that it was not their deceased loved one at all. So there has to be a way to break through the mask of deception and to test the phenomenon. And that's really what we're going to get into tonight. It's going to be a fascinating discussion.
Well, and as you were speaking, I pulled out my Roman ritual. Yeah, and I've got an old one, folks. Latin on the right, English on the left. I won't read from the Ecclesiastic Latin because it's silly to write in Ecclesiastic Latin things that are just paragraphs. I've always wondered why it's written in Latin on the left when it's just instructions. yeah, but at the funny. Beginning, right here in page 169, Exorcism of the Possessed, it's talking about things that the priest needs to be careful of, things that the exorcist needs to be wary of. And let's start off with number four. In order to understand these matters better, let him inquire of the person possessed, following upon one or the other act of exorcism that the latter experienced in his body or soul while the exorcism was being performed, and to learn also what particular words in the form had a more intimidating effect upon the devil. So not many people realize that when you finish being exorcised, this is the exorcist talking to the exorcee. So what seemed to pull things more? Literally finding out from them, from their point of view, being trapped inside, what seemed to provide more light as they were trapped. Very interesting that they would go through like an immediate decompression session.
Right.
Like, right. You're there and you're founded enough to go through a decompression session with your exorcist. And number five, he will be on his guard against the arts and subterfuges which the evil spirits are wont to use in deceiving the exorcist. For oftentimes they will give deceptive answers and make it difficult to understand them, so that the exorcist might tire and give up, or so it might appear that the afflicted is no wise possessed by the devil. Once in a while, they are already recognized. They conceal themselves and leave the body practically free of every molestation. So the victim believes himself completely delivered. Yet the exorcist may not desist until he sees signs of deliverance. So even right here in the ritual, it is telling the exorcist, like, be on your guard. It will disguise itself as people that you know. It will say that it knows you. It will say it knows your heart. It knows your sin. It knows your past. It knows your future.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And in some cases, it has demonstrated that to such a high degree. There's one researcher that he was in a seminary and he was in the middle of an exorcism with his mentors and the priests that he was being taught by. And in his mind, he said, "This is baloney. It's not real." And so he was ready to just walk out. And so at that point, the demoniac or the possessed individual snapped to attention, looked right at him, and spoke perfect Malay. Wow. And it wasn't until this researcher, he's a researcher now, but it wasn't until he graduated from the seminary that the priests that were present in that exorcism pulled him aside into an office and said, "Okay, have a seat. We want to now that you're out of academia here, we want to ask you if you understood what that individual, that possessed individual, said to you." And he said, "No, I had no idea. You know, it wasn't Latin, wasn't Greek, wasn't Hebrew." They said, "Okay, it was perfect Malay, and we had to look it up ourselves. But according to our translation, it was, 'I was there when your father killed himself, and I'm the one who made him pull the trigger.'"
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And so, again, wow. It's the knowledge base where who died, how did they die, when did they die, yeah. And then the way that they use that information. I mean, there's nothing that any person, even an entity, could have said to that individual, that researcher, that would have hurt him as deeply and have caused as much damage emotionally as that sentence did.
And quite literally, the fact that he did not speak Malay is the only thing that saved him from that.
Of course, right. He had to be mature enough 4 years later to hear it. And he did a lecture at the Exeter Festival of Exeter Conference, one of the two. And he was talking about this event, and he's like 60 years old, and he was choking up crying about it. I mean, so whatever we're dealing with, it has the preternatural knowledge of the afterlife, which is something that, I mean, if we go just based off of the biblical texts, they shouldn't have knowledge of. That's interesting to me.
Why, now let's get into that. Why is it that they shouldn't have well, I guess in theory they shouldn't have knowledge of the afterlife because they have no soul.
Right. The working.
The operating thing to be in the afterlife is to have a soul. So that way, yes, that would presume the fact that A, the heaven that we go to is the realm that they are in, which is a huge, 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 huge presumption. Huge presumption on our part.
Absolutely.
Because according to any angelic teaching, there are realms, and not all of these realms are heaven.
There are different realms,
cherubim, seraphim, all kinds of things. And not all of them dwell in the world that we know of as the spiritual, quote, heaven.
Correct. Correct. And it's a unique description. I mean, and, you know, like I said, I grew up in the evangelical movement, so it's either heaven or hell. And, you know, they would take the scriptures. I mean, again, these weren't very literate people.
We have the vagary of purgatory, whatever that is.
So yeah,
you could get into that if you want.
I'll start out with this. I mean, they take a scripture in the Bible that says, okay, it's appointed once for a man to die and then the judgment. And because their uncle told them this or their favorite Bible school teacher told them this, they don't really look at the context. And I've seen this, you know, people that watch my shows from my past, you know, I mean, you should be studying this. They think I'm a practitioner of demonology, which that's not really a real thing. Yeah. you know what I mean? It's a field of study. But anyways, they think I'm out in left field. Who cares? But they'll use that scripture to say that, okay, when a person dies, according to biblical teaching, they die, they immediately go to heaven or hell and, you know, whatever. But they don't realize that was specifically at one of the feasts of God where the high priest would go and make a sacrifice. It was in one of the Pauline Gospels. And then Yahweh would judge the sacrifice. And so what Paul was trying to compare was that we do have a high priest in Jesus Christ, and he's not only the high priest, but he's the sacrifice. And so it's appointed once for him to die, and then he, the sacrifice, will be judged for the sins of the world. All that. Well, they take it out of context, but, you know, we don't know but getting back to this idea that according to the demonology and the Old Testament, New Testament, we have no reason to believe these beings know who died and when they died. It wasn't until I got into the Watcher demonology that my eyes were open. And I thought, wait a minute, this fits. Because there was a sect or a species of angels where they were designed and given understandings of the afterlife because they were in charge of souls and in charge of the deceased. And these are one of the groups of angels that fell.
Yeah.
So what makes more sense to me in that realm of thought is, yes, that these are watcher angels, or at least what our ancestors believed to be watcher angels. It makes sense as to why they would have knowledge of the afterlife, where bodies are placed, and whose souls are existing. So I think it's a fascinating discussion, but there is something beyond, and whatever we're dealing with knows about it, if not exists in it.
Yeah, no, precisely. And the idea of the Nephilim to begin with, the idea that upon the earth there were watchers sent, there were people sent to guard over the earth, a specific group of angels, and that the Nephilim came from them, the sons of the fallen.
Correct.
That once they started lusting after the wives of men, and took the wives of men as their own, there begat an entire race of humanity that was now part demon seed, part human, which sets about a whole different story arc and storyline and bloodline. And when you start looking at, oh man, when you especially start breaking apart the whole concept of, quote, sins of the fathers.
Yes. Yes.
That has directly to do with bloodline, and it has directly to do with bloodline of that, and of the fallen. And yeah, like supposedly that is why the flood occurred, was to cleanse the earth of these fallen, and some survived, which is what we're talking about now. The idea that these things, these beings, these demon, part human, now require part humanity to survive and to continue.
Yes.
It's not that the fallen ones, the ones that were sent here, the watchers, are the ones who need humanity. They need no humanity for their continuance. Their continuance is in perpetuity. Like they, you know, the only difference between them and us is we have a soul, we have a choice, we have a chance for redemption. They have none. They were given grace, and as soon as they fall from it, it's gone, it's stripped, it never returns.
Yes, sir. They know their time. That's what's interesting. I can still remember reading that passage in the Bible where the heavy footfall of a sandal from Nazareth lands on the beach shore. And here comes a demoniac, and Yeshua HaMashiach looks at him. The demoniac falls at his feet and starts to worship. And then they ask a peculiar question. Have you come to torment us before our time?
Yeah.
So they know. Now, if we could, I would like to unpack this concept of the fallen angel before it was reincorporated into Hebrew consciousness. Now, there are different terms that preceded the fallen angel hypothesis. Now, let's go shoot from the hip, my friend. The word fallen angel is not even mentioned in the Hebrew text. It's a concept.
Yeah.
And so that's why I think it's worth just unpacking for a fleeting moment. Now, we have, like I said, there are different terms in Mesopotamian literature that kind of give us the background from which this concept originates. Number one, in ritual bowls, written in Ugaritic texts, there were a species of beings called the Repiumai. And the Repiumai were deceased kings, deceased doctors, exorcists, numerous amount of pillars in the local community, legends, heroes, warriors. And they called it Repiumai. And then it's so fascinating because it was not just Repiumai, but these particular people prayed to these Repiumai. And so this Repiumai concept of deceased kings, deceased warriors and deceased pillars of the community, it entered into Hebrew consciousness as Rephaim. Now, the Rephaim has two different meanings. It's incredible. The first meaning is giants. The second meaning is phantoms or ghosts. That's why, again, when we're reading Genesis 6, the author is assuming we already know who he's talking about. Why? That's why when scholars, the sons of God, well, who are the sons of God? And the only way we can understand that is by looking at these texts retrospectively or retroactively, right? Looking back at them and saying, okay, this is what it means to us now. Therefore, that's what it must have meant to them then. And that's what a lot of American researchers do, but it's not true. What did these passages mean to them when they were written? And so that's why Rephaimai and Rephaim were not just kings or giants. Was also talking about the aspect of consciousness that allegedly survived bodily death.
Yeah.
This is why in Genesis 6, it comes back to men of renown. Who are they?
Yeah.
They're the Rephaim. They're the Rephaimai. Now this same concept bleeds into the fallen angel hypothesis. Now, you know me, man. If I start to ramble, just go to break. No, just kidding. Yeah. So then the angel hypothesis, when you get into like the Akkadian text, Phoenician text, even Ugarit, there is a term called Malakuma. In Malakuma, it meant deceased ancestor or a divine mediator, in that it was really these people were a part of a death cult to which they believed that when certain people die, they transition to a semi-divine being to which they pray to. Hello, Catholicism.
Yeah.
Right. And sadly, but that was their whole concept on it. And so when we land in Genesis 6, that is the foundation. That's the root system that branches off into the legend of the fallen angel and of the watchers. Now, what they were telling us in the text, even with the watchers falling, if you look not just to the Hebrew consciousness and all that stuff, you look at the actual body of work in Mesopotamia, it was that there were people who died that made a pact with the watchers who watched over them.
Yeah.
And ta-da, we have the re-embodiment of the dead living in the living. And this gets back to the hybridization program. This gets back into the giants. And I can keep on going. But again, the Rephaim are not just fallen angels or anything like that. It was essentially a concept of the re-embodiment of the dead. And I believe this is the working theory that I'm nestled in my research, because I think that all theories originate from the Levant. Anyways.
Well, and specifically when you were talking about the Rephaim, now I'm going to pop up on screen real quick. The map of the firmament. Because you really do have to kind of understand the world of the ancient Hebrew and what they believe, because they do not believe even Orthodox Judaism does not believe, perhaps Reform Judaism believes in the whole heaven hell concept, things like that, but in the original texts, there was the firmament, and inside of that firmament was Sheol. And that is where everybody went. There was no heaven. There was no hell. There was Sheol. And this goes back to the concept of the way that the Greeks saw things, which is why there was just the underworld. There was the only way you went to the heavens was if you became part god. If you were like Hercules, or if you were so renowned that you had a constellation named after you, now you were in the heavens. But aside from that, everybody went to the underworld. Everybody. Good man, bad man, didn't matter. you went to the same place. And in ancient Hebrew tradition, that Sheol was a place of waiting until the time of final judgment.
Correct.
So, you weren't dead. It wasn't a point of finality when you died. It was a point of waiting. You were in a point of stasis until the time of final judgment came.
Correct.
So that changes the rules. It changes the games. You have not gone into a light.
Right.
That you cannot come back from.
Correct. Correct. And what I love about this topic is, and this is the strangest thing in demonology, people think that the concept of demonology is monolithic, and that the ancient Hebrew mind in the Old Testament, their version of demonology was the same version of demonology in the New Testament. It's not true.
Yeah.
And, you know, anybody with a cursory knowledge of this subject matter, anybody that just pick up a book by T. Witten Davies will see it. You know, they evolved according to the manifestation of the phenomenon. And so a lot of this stuff is, even the Greek mythology here we're talking about, a lot of it's rooted in the Enuma Elish, or the Babylonian creation flood story. Now, this is fascinating to me personally. It says that the ghost of a man is made from the flesh of a god.
Yes.
And what is the ghost of a man? Well, that's, you know, post-conscious or post-death. It's out of body experience. It's all of the above. But they consider the fact that consciousness had a texture to it. It had constitution to it. And it wasn't just something that can walk through a wall, but it could solidify to the touch, which we've seen that in ontology. But this getting back to the divine ancestor theory, that there are some people who, when they die, they can be prayed to. And if you look in, there we go. If you look into it, even with the understanding of Jesus after he died.
Yes.
Before he had, right? If, you know, touch me not, for I have not yet ascended. How? Well, if I can't touch something, why are you telling me I can't? You know what I mean? It was able. You could touch it, but he didn't want to be touched. And so there is this liminal existence between heaven and earth, between life and death. And I think that whatever we're dealing with exists in that space. No pun intended, by the way.
Oh, no. And I'm actively bringing up, I'm actively bringing up the quote right now, about when the woman touched Jesus's garment, because this is important. Now, there was a woman who had been suffering from hemorrhages for 12 years. And though she had spent all she had on physicians, no one could cure her. She came up behind Jesus and touched his clothes, and immediately her hemorrhage stopped. Jesus asked, "Who touched me?"
Who touched me?
He immediately knew, and it wasn't because of the pull of his garment.
Right.
It was because of his energy leaving.
Absolutely.
That happened. And to understand that, perhaps Christ was one of these, quote, men of renown.
Oh, absolutely. I think that's true. You know, and you have to understand my perspective, not just you, I'm talking about in general. You know, I come from the evangelical movement. My dad would fly Hebrew scholars straight from Israel to our house, and I'd get to hang out with them for a week. So I'd be able to pick their brain as a kid. And what you see here is just the petri dish of Mesopotamian legends and lore that seeped into the cross-cultural understanding of Hebrew consciousness.
Absolutely.
And so that's why, again, you're dealing with borrowed, what are called loan words. You know, what's Rephaim? Well, they were Rephaimai. Okay. And so this gets back into Malakuma, which I was going to talk about. I forgot about it. Malakuma in the Ugarit, again, was a deceased ancestor, men and woman of renown. And then when they died, they evolved into this being that was semi-divine. This gets back into Esther Amori's book, Divination in Women's Divination in Biblical Literature. She is I can't find it in my library. Anyways, she is a professor at Union Theological Seminary. She talks about when the Witch of Endor went to conjure up, not even conjure up, but went to go and speak to the ghost of Samuel. Now, again, an evangelical movement, because a lot of us don't like to look at definitions, I'm just kidding, of words, we'll sit there and say it was a familiar spirit. Well, the familiar spirit, again, the Hebrew word for familiar spirit is Yadonai. And that word is nowhere near that passage. In that text, it's called a Baal Ob. In other words, she was a master of ghosts. And so when he came out of the earth in the Hebrew text, she said, there is an Elohim. Uh-oh. Elohim coming out of the earth. And so this is where we get the plurality of Elohim. It originated from the idea that the ghost of a man is made from the flesh of a god. Now, getting back to Malakuma now. This is incredible. I love it. Malakuma, in the Ugaritic text, meant a deceased ancestor that was semi-divine because it muted, it evolved, it molted their body, and they stepped into another dimension. It's almost like, I tell people, it's almost like Gandalf the Grey becoming Gandalf the White in Lord of the Rings. He is a much more superior being now. And so that word Malakuma began to bleed into Hebrew consciousness. And now their term for angel is Malak or Malakim. Right? And this is also, it's an incredible concept. This is also why, again, Jesus or Yeshua in John 20 and 17, he says, touch me not, for I've not yet ascended to my Father. What point of his existence was he in during that passage of scripture? Was he dead? Not really.
Yeah.
Was he alive? Yeah, it wasn't resurrected.
And it's
strange.
And it also interestingly explains his first appearance after his death, which was on the road to Emmaus.
Oh man. Yeah. Yeah.
You know, where he pops up, has dinner and then disappears.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And that is what sends them running back all the way back to Jerusalem to let everybody know that he is risen. But they did not, and much like any angelic presence, and I'm getting tingles right now thinking about
it. Oh, no, it's goosebumps. Awesome.
Much like any angelic presence noted in the Bible, man, that nobody knew who they were. They were just compelled. They were compelled to keep walking with him. They were compelled to keep talking with him. They didn't know why. It wasn't until he broke the bread.
There we go. I'm going to bring that up. Yep.
That the veil was lifted
chills.
And they realized
chills.
Who it was. So, I mean, much like when the angel came to visit Abraham and Sarah laughed. And well, you know, nowhere in the Bible is anybody. I think the only person who is fully aware that they are in the presence of an angel is Mary.
Right.
And she trembles in fear.
Oh, yeah.
To the point terrifying. That the angel says, don't be afraid. That's not why I'm here. Like, because typically it wasn't a good thing.
Yeah,
if an angel was popping up, like it normally wasn't like, hey, here's a joyous occasion. You know, it was normally like, hey, just so you know, this whole city's going to be destroyed. You should let
you're
going to
get nuked.
You know, like they were sent as a warning. They were sent as something of a herald of things that were typically not good. That if you didn't change your behavior, something bad was going to happen. Even the point of the angel that came to Abraham, he was asked to sacrifice his son faith to his God. You know, that like God has asked you for a sacrifice beyond sacrifices. He would like your son Isaac. But it was a test. Mind you, but at the same time announcing something that wasn't so great. So the fact that Christ shows up in that way is pretty interesting.
It is their knowledge of spirits. Again, it evolved, and so did their philosophies and their understandings and their traditions. I mean, let's look at this case study, and we're just in the Bible. We haven't even talked about the paranormal and modernity or anything. But when Peter was believed to have been martyred, his family's in the house grieving and thinking, oh my God, we just lost Pete. What's going on? And next thing you know, there comes a knock at the door, and they look out, and there is Peter. Yep. And what they have, their response is peculiar. And a lot of people, especially in the Pentecostal movement I grew up in, you know, they just don't get it. But they asked, they said, it appears to be Peter's angel. What? Now, again, this connects us to the idea that the angel at a certain point in history was believed to be the consciousness of the deceased, which when they die, they then become an ancestor. And so the idea is that there he's put it up there. And, you know, it's incredible that they believe, you know, again, that they were looking at his apparition. Now, this is, it's fascinating.
Yeah, there it is. So they said, it is his angel. Now Peter continued knocking, and when they opened the door and saw him, they were astonished. But motioning to them with his hand to keep them silent, he declared to them how the Lord had brought him out of the prison. And he said, quote, go tell these things to James and to the brethren.
Mm-hmm. There we go.
Like almost the exact same, except Jesus didn't call them to do that. They just went and did.
Absolutely. And you know, I think it's insightful. I mean, again, we're not getting the right answers because we're not asking the right questions. And people, like I said, the only reference that I have in religious growing up in the movement I was in, but you know, what are we talking about here?
Hey, an man, angel that I'm Roman Catholic. You could not get a more obscure teaching of angel or angelic than Roman Catholicism. Like, we are the reason these things have wings. You know, like every bit of misunderstanding that we have comes from the obfuscation of the church in this topic.
I believe that too. And I have, you know, you're a dear friend to me, and I have other dear friends that are Catholic, and, you know, I respect them. I love them to death. But there are certain issues with the demonology.
Hey, man, I love my faith. I love my capital C church, not the building down the road, things like that. I love my faith and the beauty of my faith. However, I will be the first one to say, yep, we made Christmas what it is. Jesus was really more of a Virgo whenever you look at the star alignments. It's what we did. We came in and it was like, oh, wow, you have a celebration at that time? So do we. Let's just bring it on in.
Yeah, secretism. You know? Man, we'll go ahead and add that to the mix.
And you know. Absolutely. And you know, there was a definite obfuscation of things. Most definitely. There was a definite culling of texts to form a narrative. No doubt.
Sure.
No doubt. Granted, many of the texts that were there that were culled were in their minority of being read to begin with. Things like the Gospel of Mary Magdalene, the Gospel of Thomas. They have amazing, incredible stories in them. But they were read by very few sects of Christianity to begin with. Which is why they were culled. But don't get me wrong, they were culling them to create a narrative. Absoluteness. All absoluteness. And with that comes the narrative of angels, and what they are and how they are, and this continuation of a didactic of black versus white, good versus evil, that has been carried on since Zoroaster. You know, that was really the first monotheism where there was suddenly black and white, good and evil.
There's no in between.
Even what we're talking about right now, when you're talking about Hebrew tradition, deep Hebrew theology and their spiritual traditions, they go back to Sumer and they go back to Mesopotamia, which I have always held is a huge reason why the book of Genesis says first story of creation, second story of creation. I don't care which version of the Bible you pick up, my man. It could be a New Jerusalem Bible or New American Bible from the Catholic Church. It could be a King James version from your church.
Mm-hmm.
They both state first story of creation, second story of creation. There is a delineated divide between those two stories. One of them is Mesopotamian in origin. One of them is Babylonian and Sumerian in origin. Like it is from the thousands of years of tradition that they picked up as slaves before they became an independent free people. This is where their faith and began is when they were enslaved. And they picked up their stories and traditions from that and then became their own people after Moses. Mm-hmm. But you have to understand that history, and you have to understand that even their angelic teaching, even the concepts of the Kabbalah, their most mystical teaching, which is where most of this concept, Nephilim, everything else comes from, the angelic teachings, all of that is rooted in Sumer, in Babylonian tradition, and in Mesopotamia.
Yeah, absolutely, sir. And so it seems like our ancestors were trying to describe an event in history the best way they could, within their own thinking mind. Well, no, how would I describe this? So they're Malakuma, or are they Malakim? Are they Rephaim? Are they Rephaim? And so these are migratory loan words that, the Hebrew, they inherited, and they're moving on through different countries, different traditions, and they just reincorporated into their own theology. But getting back to this idea of consciousness and evolving after death, this is what the unclean spirit was. And this is what's so frustrating in my own field is, most of the demonology that people are discussing these days, it is Catholic in origin.
Yeah.
And I'm not poo-pooing that at all. What I'm saying is that the discipline of demonology is interreligious and cross-cultural. And in order to get a better understanding of the phenomenon, or at least to get a better foundation to come up with a theory, we have to understand that. We have to look at different traditions and kind of weed through the propaganda and look at the origin. And so, getting back to the unclean spirit, what was an unclean spirit in biblical antiquity? The unclean spirit came out of an unclean man. That's what Jesus said. When an unclean spirit goeth out of a man, it seeks rest. What would seek rest? These are human needs.
Yeah.
This is exactly why, this is called the curse of Cain. The earth will reject you. You will wander. And you will never find rest. And so it's incredible, because what we're really looking at in demonology is not just horns and hooves and, they're all liars. No, what was original within their consciousness was that there are entities that have what I call the disability of being without being a being. Yeah. And so it's free floating consciousness that has no body to inhabit. And so when it wants a body, then we see, now we're breaking it down. Then we see the necessity of the hybridization program in Genesis 6. That it's incredible. Now, then we see the necessity of the incubi who takes the seed and inseminates a woman and creates a fetus. It's incredible.
Yeah.
So this is what I believe. It does speak of consciousness existing out of the body.
Yep.
And it having characteristics of being semi-divine.
Well, and even right there, the belief in a supernatural non-corporeal being considered not to be as gods and or, goddess. It's a wild concept, and it is really just in our conversation today, a couple of new things have been defined for me that really, really make a lot more sense when you were talking about biblical teaching and the depth to which these things go, Nathaniel.
Yes,
because
sir.
And I'm not talking about the hiding of information, the depth of that, but the depth to which the ideal of ideation goes. Mm-hmm. And how are we putting that out into the world? You know, one of mm-hmm. one of the things that I have been talking about lately is not just the idea that we have a preconceived notion, but what is our preconceived notion doing?
Correct.
You know, much like because we believe in Sasquatch, something out in the woods may be using our trope to appear right. as something that we would be comfortable with. Because if we saw its original form, we would be like Mary, trembling in fear.
Yes, sir.
But also the idea that we're charging that atmosphere. Are we actually calling forth this thing with our want? You know, and that's one of the things I've been warning against is like, when you're preparing your gear for a paranormal investigation, don't think of the place as a haunted place. Mm-hmm. You know, don't put preconceived notions on it. You're actively charging that atmosphere. No different than the scientists who were thinking about their experiments when they went home and were affecting them, which is what led to the world of remote viewing. And that yep. science yes. is a paper written on the fact of when a scientist went home and was thinking but just thinking about his experiment, that he was affecting the outcome of his experiment. So
absolutely,
we are affecting the outcome by charging that atmosphere, by thinking about it the whole time that we're prepping gear, we're excited, we're going out to a haunted place. You know, I heard this happen, this and that. Like, you're actively putting that out there, mm-hmm. you know? So is it you or is it the place? Is now right. the phenomenology that we have to explore, you know?
Yeah, I love it. I love that's a fascinating topic.
And even the idea of these beings, are they stalking us or are they just laying in wait? Because they don't necessarily have to stalk us. They can see the ones that are open.
Absolutely. Well, to answer your question, I think it's a little bit of both. I think that they're operating off their own belief systems, their own pathologies, their own sexual pathology, their own victimologies. And I think that much of what we've learned in
their
the paranormal.
Own victimologies.
Absolutely.
Explore
absolutely.
That for a second.
Well, when you get into even ufology, the abduction of phenomenon, there is this pathology, I should say. We got a lot of ologies today where in demonology, even they prefer women. They even in possession cases, the Vatican will tell you that more women are possessed than men.
Yeah.
And it's not because, okay, women are bad, men are good. That's not at all the case. It's just that they look at possession like we look at pregnancy. In many cases, possession has led to pregnancy. And this is why when I mentor other demonologists, and I mentor maybe two or three because I'm very, very specific and picky. But, you know, I tell them that this is the benefit of researching not just Catholic demonology, but, you know, Jewish demonology and the likes, because they talk about this phenomenon where these beings have their own victimology in the sense that, you know, there are specific bloodlines they want to procreate through and replicate through. Other bloodlines they completely leave alone. And I believe this is why we have some abductees and other people live their lives thinking this is all just junk and not real, and they're completely oblivious to it. But yes, the pathologies throughout history has mostly been women. And I don't think it's for the reasons most people would suggest it is. It's so early on in demonology, they believed, okay, the angels fell in love with women because, you know, some of them like redheads, you know, they liked blondes. And it wasn't exactly because of sexuality. It was literally just them wanting to replicate with specific bloodlines. And in order to do that, they would pick and choose. Okay, I don't want this victim. I want this certain victim. And this gets back into not just demonology, but ufology, where they will monitor the fertility of women from the ages of beginning at puberty on to almost near death. And so they have their own victimologies. They have their own sexual pathologies. And my point, what I'm saying is that all of these ologies, they eclipse what we are being taught in the field right now.
Yeah.
And I think it's an incredible point, because it's necessary to understand that in order for us to go to the other depths of research.
Absolutely. And I think that is a huge reason. I will laud the church with this, Nathaniel. I've said it numerous times on the show. I'll say it again. A lot of the reason that I have problems with the church, I mean, there's, of course, child molestation, things like that. Feel free to go check the public records in your local school district, folks. You'll probably be much more appalled because it's rampant everywhere. But what disturbed me was my personal experience in the realm of spirituality. And I had had a couple of experiences with shadow people in my house. Things like that. One experience where I was grabbed by a shadow person. I brought this to my spiritual director. I had known my spiritual director since before he wore a collar officially, since he was in his diaconate preparing for his vows and or his sacred rite, rather, because priests don't take vows. Monks take vows. When I brought it up to him, he basically said that the church does not have a teaching on this, Chris. Like, I would love to give you some direction, but there's nothing in my big green book back here about that. And I was like, well, we have a rite of exorcism. Yeah. He's like, yeah, but you know, there's a lot that goes into that. And you know, I don't know. So the fact that my faith had zero answers for me, zero answer, was disturbing to me. And the fact, and I told them flat out, like, the fact that you want me to believe beyond belief upon spectral evidence, but when provided evidence of the spectral, you have no belief. And I find that in great conflict,
like
point of mental conflict that I could not handle. I have my faith. Mm-hmm. I have my beliefs. I am solid with that. I will bring my son up with that. Should he ever want to go to a church, I'm perfectly cool with that. At that point I was pretty done with a lot of things, because I saw it just as a superficial. Nobody was trying to dig deeper. Nobody, you're telling me that something dark is stalking my soul around every corner. But when I tell you something dark touched me physically, you're like, meh.
Yeah, it didn't happen. You're crazy. And I think that's troubling. And I encountered some of that with the church I grew up in. It's like, okay, it's the devil. And their idea, you know, well, devils do devil things. And if they're not doing devil things, well, you know, whatever.
Well, grabbing me in my sleep is pretty devil.
Yeah. Yeah, like, no doubt. You know what I mean? And I've experienced that myself. It's troubling.
Yeah.
But this gets back into research and the damning nature of being dogmatic. Mm. I hate to say it like that, but it's really what it is, because my understanding of demonology growing up originated from a guy who wasn't even a demonologist. He was like a faith healer. His name was Jonathan Subri. He's a missionary. He's kid from Africa. And so he comes over and like powerful guy. I mean, he wasn't one of those guys that spits on people and, like, you know, throws their jackets and stuff and is worth $100 million. He just, you know, he has a little church in Texas, but he was a powerful guy. But he was telling stories about, you know, he's walking by this young girl at a revival, and in perfect French, when she was in the South. So either she didn't know French or she did, but the probability of her knowing it was slim. And I'm not, you know, edit that out. No, I'm saying, like, you know,
The odds of them knowing each other were next to nil.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. She wasn't from Africa, is what I've said. Yeah. So anyways, she spoke in perfect French and said, "Hello, Jonathan. Do you remember me?"
Ooh.
And he looked at her. And it's incredible because, yes, he said, "I cast you out of a man in Ghana." And she said, "Yes, you did. You're going to cast me out again?" In French. And this girl, again, she was speaking English 5 minutes before. And that's why I said, you know, she was from America. So it was kind of, you know, and he's like, "Yes, I cast you out before. I'll cast you out again." So he cast her out. Anyway, so that was my understanding of demonology as it was given to me by their tradition. And here's the problem with being stagnant in our understanding of this topic. It's not monolithic. They evolve. We evolve according, you know, to what their manifestations are. And if we're not keeping tabs on what they're doing today and just what they've done yesterday, then we're going to be at a loss. Because when ufologists come forward and they give us today's mail, and we don't, you know, we're not studying present demonology and current demonology, and we're stuck in the past, then we really do not have the proper understanding needed to approach these subjects. And that's why I think that dogmatism is the coffin that the brain is buried in.
Yeah. Yeah. It really is. It's a box that's been put in a box, and that's where your thought is. And that's, that is one of the things I've been saying very recently about the whole whistleblower thing, all that kind of stuff, is that the plus side is that we have now taken things by redefining them as UAP and taken them out of the box. Because for the longest time, science said we won't look at it because it's not in our box of science. Mm-hmm. And now people are saying, "I'm not going to study it because it's not in my box of what I call UFO." We want to put everything in a box called Kleenex. Nathaniel,
there we go.
There are 100 different forms of tissue paper out there. What do you call it? It's all a Kleenex.
It's all a Kleenex.
There's 100 different ways to make a copy. It's all called a Xerox, you know, and as soon as we give it a name, unfortunately, we've now given it a dogmatic practice, and without that dogmatic practice, it isn't.
Oh, of course, of course.
Which means the question, that we can ignore it and not study it and push it aside.
Yeah, and we are no longer responsible. We're not intellectually accountable to have to know these other traditions, and so we're limited, and because we're limited, it creates an easier platform for the phenomenon to manifest. And that's why, okay, Christians, it's Jesus; Muhammad, it's Buddha. I was working with a lady not too long ago where she was being abducted as a child, and her knowledge base was strictly cartoons. You know, she didn't have YouTube at the time, so it was cartoons and comic books. And so when they took her, they manifested as a cartoon. So this is my point, and I know we'll get to this here in a second. This is pretty interesting. Getting back into the masks that they wear and the role-playing that they perform, there has to be a reason why they step into roles. And it gets back to consent. Because this particular woman, she said that as she began to age, the phenomenon had not adjusted the program. They were working on her. And so one day she said, "I'm growing, I'm maturing, and I'm not watching as many cartoons as I used to. I'm not reading as many comic books as I used to." And yet when it manifested to her, it's that same old image of the cartoon. And that's when she started to disbelieve in that particular image that she was being presented. And this is her testimony. She said that when she started questioning if this was even real, the phenomenon caught it in real time. And its eyes began to move like it was focusing, like a camera would focus. And she said it was almost like it was measuring her literacy and her belief, and then bam, the next time it manifested something completely different. So there is this game that's being played between the phenomenon and us that makes me question, are they manifesting to us or are they manifesting through us?
Indeed.
Who is conjuring who here during these encounters? And so when, like, for instance, there was this famous psychic medium, but before he stepped into his gifting, he was, or his whatever you want to call it, he was a child and he was in his room at nighttime. He had family over and his deceased grandpa was in the room with him, just manifested. And, it looked like him, it talked like him, it acted like him. And so in this moment, that entity is leaning on that child's belief.
Yeah.
Do you believe I am who I appear to be? Now, belief, for some reason, and I'm still researching this, but belief is a form of consent. And I think that's why it's stepping into these roles, because in order for it to manipulate, it has the image it manifests as has to be believed in.
Yeah.
The moment you question it is the moment the mask begins to disintegrate. But to end this particular case study, it manifested as the deceased grandfather, and then the deceased grandfather tried to assault him. And that's when he realized that the persona and morality of this being did not match up with the man he knew as his grandfather. So there has to be a testing mechanism in place. We have to question these spirits.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, and don't get me wrong. If Huckleberry Hound appeared in my room in the middle of the night, I'd drop something. That would be a frightening experience for me.
It should be. Yes. Yes. What is this? Right. And the whole thing though is,
but the fact is, once again, that it used these familiar images with her, left her alone for years, and then came back and used the same familiar image.
Absolutely.
And when it didn't click, changed the program on the fly.
Program, key point, program. In my book, The Skin That Crawls, I talk about the incubi and succubi and how my research is leading me to believe that these are not persons. These are not people. These are not things. And programs where there's something going on here where it's a virtual reality experience. Do you believe I am who I appear to be? And they'll measure it. I don't know how, but they'll measure it. Okay, how much? This is why, when people are abducted by Jesus – and Jesus essentially teaches them something that's anathema to what he taught in biblical antiquity. It's fascinating because I've been telling people this in my lectures, where do you really think that these beings would have taken the late Michael Heiser or the late Chuck Missler and appeared as Jesus to tell them some lie? No, why? Because they would have compared the teaching of that entity to the teaching of Jesus in antiquity.
Yeah.
Now, this is a major point that I'm about to share with you.
Please.
When we are in the midst of testing these beings, we've had them appear as everything on the table. Muhammad to Muslims, Jesus to Christians, ghosts to grieving people, cartoons to children. We have to realize something, that when you're in a game, you have characters that have characteristics. This is what they do. This is what they've done, and the whole gamut. And so that's why when Dear Aunt Edna appears, is it Dear Aunt Edna? What is she telling me? I have something to compare it to in history. Yeah. But my point is, we have a way of vetting them. But the problem is created when the program introduces an alien character, because now we do not have the ability to vet them.
Yeah.
We have to go by their own words.
Well, and we have to go by our own belief and our own allowed belief, what we allow ourselves to believe. And as long as we believe it, then it is consented, like you just said. You know,
consent.
And even the idea, because I belong to a lot of online groups, as you know, Nathaniel, you're in a few of them. But there was one recently where I've got to think of it just blew my mind, because people were talking about how there was a time gap between somebody dying and being able, and granted, you know, there's a time gap if you're looking at things in a Buddhist sense, as far as what the soul progresses and what the spirit progresses over time and things like that. But they were talking about a time gap between when somebody dies and when they can appear. And I was like, I find that very spurious, mainly because time is here. Like, we specifically here in this space, in this sphere called Earth, have mutually as human beings decided to slice time into this mutual agreement of 60 seconds to 60 minutes to 23 or to 60 minutes to an hour to 23.28 hours to a day. You know, by the rotation of the Earth and by the rotation of the Earth around the sun, that is what we have defined it by. So I don't think once you hit that spiritual realm that you're down with time. I don't think you're looking at a clock waiting. Oh, man, I got 32 hours left before I can go talk to Aunt Edna.
It's, you know, a strange theory that we can't prove.
I don't think that's the case. So I guess what I'm getting to is the idea of one of these spirits possibly using the form of a recently passed loved one, specifically if they're using the form of a recently passed loved one that maybe you weren't close to.
Right.
That would literally have no reason whatsoever to appear to you. You know, like if you knew Aunt Edna 3-4 times in your life, you saw her at 3 or 4 family reunions, you know, as especially we in America here are prone to do, you know, have very distant relatives that we see very little, but that we know about. There's pictures of them, things like that. They pop up at every 5th Christmas. You know, you see him at a few with my dad's side of the family. We always laugh at, well, see you at the next funeral, buddy. You know, we see each other when somebody gets married or somebody dies. That's about it. You know,
right.
So the idea of, like, let's say my cousin Jeff on my dad's side passing and appearing to me. I would find that very interesting. Because I love you, Jeff, and you may very well be listening, but because we've reconnected on Facebook. So he may very well be listening because he is a deep spiritual individual. But I don't know if Jeff would come to me, you know, like,
right.
Because we aren't close like that. And I choose to believe, this is just me, that if somebody is going to spend the effort, I would consider it to be a decent amount of effort to bust through the veil, you know, that maybe they would be shooting for somebody who they truly, truly have a message for, that they are heavily connected with, you know. So to me, if cousin Jeff died and the next day I had cousin Jeff visiting me, yeah, I might take that into consideration, you know. Is that Jeff or is it not?
This gets back to the information we're receiving, not just from demons, but aliens and all the various masks that they hide behind. And I truly believe that. The problem is we don't know how to vet them. I even remote viewers, you know, there seems to be this bubble around our consciousness that even the information that we get, we cannot really understand. Okay, is it good or is it bad? Is it true or is it false? This is propaganda. And so that's why, okay, well, I got this out of body. Well, does it mean it's real? Or does it mean it's right? Does it make sense? And that's what troubles me more than anything. I mean, if we look at the phenomenon, if it can manifest as ghosts, which it has during UFO abductions, then why can't it manifest as ghosts in hauntings?
Yeah.
Right. And it's like, what? Oh, you know, people, well, I research hauntings. Okay. But do we really know we're researching? You know, okay. Yeah. I mean, even in.
And once again, are you inviting that spirit mm-hmm. through your own preparation? Is that in right. and of itself? And your excited preparation of things and putting that onto the space, are you charging it and inviting that spirit or that fallen spirit to embody itself as the spirit that you're investigating?
Oh, man. You're hitting the nail on the head, and it reminds you of something that I just forgot. I forgot earlier, but check this out. So again, when you're doing that, yes, the phenomenon has the ability to manifest as, okay, what you're expecting. And then sometimes it's almost like at a certain point, it steps out of that role and demonstrates a rule breaking that really kind of messes with our minds. I was on another show, and he was this big show, and he was talking to me about how he was on an investigation, and he had a priest there because this house had a demon in it. And so the priest pulled out a vial of holy water, placed it in the middle of the room, and they just sat there for about an hour. And as the minutes went by, they noticed that that entity was siphoning the holy water out of the vial itself. It was full, and it kept getting lower and lower and lower. So there are times, even with Carmen Snedeker in The Haunting in Connecticut, they told her to place a crucifix over her doorframe, and that the being, entity, demon, will not inhabit that room because of, you know, divine protection. And sure enough, the next day she wakes up to find that the crucifix was thrown across the room, and now the entity has moved into that living space. So you're right. It's we've got to test them. But even the demon mask, the demonic mask, I think it really doesn't fully capture what we're dealing with. I think that whatever we're dealing with is a proto-intelligence that our ancestors tried to quantify as something. And in order to place a face on the phenomenon, well, it's got to be horns and hooves. I would suggest that the same phenomenon that's behind demonology is the same phenomenon that's behind ufology, in that what it's done is it's evolved according to awareness of it. Now, if I can finish this,
please.
This is incredible. Please. This is why when Kenneth Arnold was flying in his plane and he saw these flying saucers, he didn't see flying saucers. He said that he saw UFOs that were skipping like saucers. And yet the next few years, you see UFOs and witnesses of UFOs, and they say, okay, yeah, what I saw was shaped just like a saucer. Is it manifesting to them, or is it manifesting through them? And
much
so there
like
is
the cubes that are being seen now.
Right.
It's interesting how since the release of the cube video, things like that a year or so ago, it is fully mm-hmm. interesting to see the phenomenology of the shape of UFOs changing shape.
Correct.
You know,
correct. And it's measuring what, okay. And then now there's, my brother used to be a part of a research team where they were, you know, cameras all across the country, and actually across a portion of our country that had a high volume of manifestation and phenomena. And, I'm talking thousands, Christopher, like they're putting them on, you know, the trees, telephone poles, everything. And he was sent footage, a video of something. Originally, these researchers believed it was a plane. And so at first blush, they're, okay, it's a plane, no big deal. They documented it in their data and so they're gonna move on to the next video. But then when they slowed it down and zoomed in, it manifested out of nowhere in the sky. And what they saw in the beginning was not the same thing that they saw at the end of the video. Originally, what they saw, what it looked like, was a life form. And they watched it. This is going to blow your mind. They watched it in real time as it changed shape and contorted itself. And then we saw it at the end of the video. Oh, that's a Cessna. and even getting deeper, we have case study after case study after case study where a lot of these UAPs, and I believe that's why they changed it from UFO to UAP, is when it manifests, it manifests as something that wants to appear as a UFO. Oh, and when you look at it, there are certain technological features that do not have the ability to facilitate flight.
Yeah.
Period. Much less space travel. You couldn't put them on I-75 and make it go 20 miles an hour because the way it's manifesting, the, you know, the bolts would fall out. But again, it's manifesting because it wants to appear as something, but it's really not what it appears as. And this gets back to, okay, what would I believe a UFO looks like? What do I believe a plane looks like? What do I believe a demon looks like? And yet, and now we have the newest character. Oh, it's an alien. Big eyes, bulbous eyes, bulbous head, right? And so that's what I'm thinking is it's that there is an interactive experience occurring. Now, moving even deeper, we know anybody worth their salt in this field in terms of researchers, we know deception is occurring. It's a fact. The only question we're asking ourselves now is, are we being deceived for our own good? And I could tell you, in some cases, people say, yeah, we were. But in many other cases, we're being deceived for the purpose of replicating their species and falling into the trap that they have created.
Yeah. And, you know, it's interesting because I had a very famous remote viewer tell me privately that he had viewed the Greys, and what part of the problem with the Greys was that yes, there is a reverse engineering program going on because they have given us technology on purpose because they are basically a hive mind, and in order to get to that, they had to give up individuality. With that goes creativity, ingenuity. It's all out the window now. Great that you have all this fantastic technology, but you have no new way to apply it. You can't invent anything. You have given up your individuality. So they are coming to us to help invent things with their technology to help their society.
Interesting.
Pretty interesting take.
Absolutely.
And that is what he says. He is remote viewed. I could see that absolutely being a case. And we do have to question, we do have to wonder, what the motivation of these things in the sky are. There have been cases, I am very, very good friends with numerous people on the MUFON Experiencer Resource Team, who deal with abductees, who deal with people who are contactees. And there are many stories that are so similar, Nathaniel, so similar, in experience, in how these people have been contacted and how these people, have been experimented on. And we do have to ask ourselves, are all of them full on that experience, or are they using that experience that somebody may be familiar with to, as you have said, seed people for a future demonic generation, no different than the people believe that they are part of an alien seeding program to seed alien life here. You know, no,
yes,
and that they are re-abducted and the fetus taken. There have been numerous cases of disappeared fetus syndrome where fetuses just vanish from people.
They vanish. Absolutely. Missing twin syndrome.
Yep.
And I really mean that.
Yeah.
And what's fascinating is there's the possibility that they know which egg is being fertilized or which egg they fertilized. And so they leave one, take the other. That's theirs. It's very strange. That's one of probably the strangest phenomena about everything we're talking about. But absolutely. And so you look at the case studies, there are incredible interconnectivities. And one thing that I've been trying to suggest to people in the field, and thankfully for the last 3 years, many of them are hearing, and I know as much as people in ufology want to, you know, they're listening to my research. They're hearing it, and at least they're considering it. But that's why I suggest it's important to understand that if you look at the phenomenon as a singular intelligence behind these various masks, then it provides us the opportunity to look beyond the veil, and instead of limiting them with titles and descriptions, now we can say, okay, all we're doing is revealing the texture of the mask. We're not really seeing beyond it. And that's why my book, The Skin That Crawls, demons are not what they say they are. They're what they do.
Yeah.
That's the truth. That's why, okay, it's my dear Edna. What is she saying? What is she doing? It's not, and this is where we are right now, especially in the 21st century, dealing with the abduction phenomenon, because the program has introduced a new character to us. We can no longer vet it with the history, with the past.
Well,
now,
go ahead. Please.
Well, now what we're doing is we're somehow believing that because the Pentagon has been able to document our manifestations, that their message to us is true.
Yeah.
When has that ever happened?
Yeah, yeah. No, and that's what I've said since the beginning. I don't know a single time that any alphabet agency has ever been called before Congress where they haven't been found to be lying.
Indeed. Good point. I'll wait.
Feel free to dig up the footage.
Oh, yes.
Because
no doubt,
it's pretty common. It's what their job is. Like the CIA is spies.
Oh,
like we pay them to lie. But to me, especially right now in the field of any of this, I think you have some of the best hypothesis out there when it comes to this topic. Wow. Nathaniel,
Thank you, sir. Thank you, sir.
It takes right now is open heart and open mind on this topic to disclude this or this concept. Mm-hmm. I think is very dangerous.
Yes,
I think I think it's inordinately dangerous because right now we have a big conundrum going on, not only hypostatically as a humanity, but ontologically, we don't know where our footing is. There was a point in time where didn't really matter what your creed was. You knew that somebody was spiritually grounded in some way. And we have lost a lot of that. I'm not saying that that's a bad thing. I am one of the people that fully says, you know, we're supposed to have anarchists running. Like we're supposed to have an anarchist on the ticket, like, so that we know the balanced choice between things, that without the option, we have no contrast, and without contrast, there is no definition in a picture, you know? And that's necessary. And to once again, disclude this topic, to disclude the idea that any technology out there wouldn't be able to manifest itself in any way at once.
Is
to me alien, because we're dealing, what we have decided to do once again is to rip the box open.
Yes.
And to try to put it back in a box, it does it disservice, all of it, to think that this and the spiritual, and it's strange because I'm a big believer in nuts and bolts. I'm a big believer in the work of MUFON. Big believer.
Me too.
Lifetime member of MUFON and lifetime supporter. But I believe in the woo. Nathaniel, like I have had my moments of woo in the world, like personal moments. They're moments that changed my life. My moment of grand revelation in a church changed my life. Nobody else experienced that in that place that day. That was for me. much like any other UFO experience where you see something and the three people around you don't. That experience was for you. But we have to break that apart, and we have to be willing to wonder why we were the ones amongst everybody, you know? And and the idea that, something might be using us. We have to get, we have to have that as something in our mind. That is a concept that we have to fully accept, that we may be very well influencing that, and that we may be opening that gate. Like, it's a dangerous thing to think and to say. But so many of the practices, even the idea for me of CE5, the CE5 protocols, you know, and like it borders on seance, and I'm okay.
Oh my God, it does.
I'm okay.
Yeah.
But are you willing to question your experience when it happens? You know, and are you willing to, say that that may be something that's trying to use you, you know, like, hey, I'm getting ready to watch it. I watch it every year at Halloween. I just watched it a couple months ago, The Exorcist. It did not say, hi, my name's Pazuzu, African God of the West Wind. I've got Pazuzu on my, over my left shoulder in my shelf over there. But no, its name was Captain Howdy.
There you go.
To Reagan. It was a familiar voice that was a friend that was funny that made, oh, Captain Howdy, don't say that. You know, and then things went awry. It was whatever it took to get that consent from Reagan. And I would posit the fact of one of the reasons why females would be targeted is because of their guiling ways. The demon, the spirit could absolutely use that to further itself through our consent toward them. We would much rather consent to the wiles of a woman.
Absolutely. Now we see that in succubi cases.
Yeah.
I mean, through and through and through and through. But getting to the mask that they're wearing, it does seem to be that they're evolving according to our awareness. And, you know, are you okay? Are you aware of this mask? Right. Okay. Yeah. And then it evolves. And what's so fascinating about this, looking at this phenomenon through a macro lens, there are certain evolutions of the phenomenon, but there are also certain agendas that even as they change the mask, they reincorporate it because it's still important to them. This is why we have to look at, you know, not just abductions, we have to look at incubi encounters, not just the incubi encounters, but the Dubuque phenomenon, 16th century. The hybridization program is not modern. It's a modern interpretation of an ancient phenomenon. And when you look in antiquity, these kids went missing too. Even in demonological literature, the babies that originated between demonic and human relations, if they were not taken from the womb, they were taken almost immediately after being born. That's fascinating.
Yeah.
Where'd our child go? Where'd the child go? He's gone. Really? Who took him? The phenomenon. The phenomenon did. Even in the 16th century, this gets back to the CE5 movement, and it's conjuring. I call it conjuring, CE5, and conjuring entities. And so in the 16th century, the same phenomenon manifested. The only difference was that this particular tradition believed that they were encountering the deceased. Not unlike some abductees when they're in the ship and they encounter a deceased loved one or an ancestor or someone they didn't even know was dead until they went back home. Same phenomenon. Anyways, but they're thinking, okay, we're going to be contacting ghosts and deceased loved ones, and we're going to get insights into that next world, that next dimension. Now, you know, today's intention is, okay, I want to get insight and technology and that whole thing. But these people were going out, and this is insane because people are going to say I make this up, but I promise you I'm not making this up. In the 16th century, these individuals really believed that their intentions with the phenomenon determined the phenomenon's intentions with them. And wouldn't you know, that many of these women, after performing these rituals and going out and trying to contact the ether, they would go home, and in the middle of the night, a dream demon would induce them into sleep and then inseminate them with a fetus.
Wow.
And to the point that it wasn't just the fetus that they were pregnant with. They were also pregnant with the entity that had assaulted them. This is why we, again, I've done hundreds of shows. Oh, my God, it's a hybridization program. It's usually looked through the lens of modernity. And therefore, it has to be this. It's alien DNA. And I understand all that. I'm not discounting that. What I'm suggesting is we have other case studies in the fold that we need to at least recognize.
Yeah.
And I'll finish with this, at least this point. In these case studies, the women were possessed by an invading consciousness to the point that they were pregnant with the fetus. Very interesting. So it was an incubi and it was a possessing entity. Now, this led demonologists to ask the following question. Were these women pregnant by the incubus or were they pregnant with it? And they would perform the lavouche. They would take the thumb, put it on the wrist. They would feel two heartbeats in the same body, two pulses in the same body, even to the point that the women were showing like they had a fetus in their womb. Now, upon exorcism, when the phenomenon removed the consciousness that invaded that woman's body, so also did they remove the fetus they had implanted. And in these case studies, suddenly we realize the pathology here. The purpose of the hybridization program is for them to place consciousness into the fetus and then to take both of them out at the same time.
Interesting.
Which would lead me to believe that we are dealing with unclean spirits that need a body to possess.
Interesting. Yeah. The idea of, once again, the offspring of the Raphaim.
And
so you know, folks, there. Would you rather have Captain Howdy or Pazuzu? Because that's Pazuzu for you right there. That'll probably get this entire episode banned because of Pazuzu's phallus.
Oh, no. It's fallacy. His phallus is a fallacy.
Yeah, but in all sincerity, yes, to know that these things need physical flesh, especially the realm that you're talking about, that are in between the ones that were born of flesh.
Oh,
because they weren't fully spiritual to begin with. They were born of flesh. They were part flesh, part that. And they have the means by which to continue themselves so long as they have the flesh. They are not like us where their spirit goes to Sheol or to the darker light, depending on what you're talking about. Their spirit stays here because of part of what they are. They were here
the
to
liminal.
Begin with. Yeah.
Yes, sir. This also bleeds into the disability of being. I mean, the necessity to replicate through the womb is very interesting to me. Dare I say, fascinating. Because right now in the 21st century, even as we're peasants in terms of technology compared to them. And if they are so technologically advanced, why couldn't they create an artificial womb? Why do they want to be gestated within the womb of a woman? What is the purpose? This is why in my lecture, one of my lectures is called The Pathology of Possession. And when you're looking at the essence of Genesis 6, the men of renown, the legend of the Rephaim, the dead being re-embodied amongst the living, it is throughout all of Mesopotamian literature. Something occurred in that changed their perspective of the afterlife, their perspective of souls, demons, angels, all of it. And in this literature, we're talking about the re-embodiment of the dead in the living. wouldn't you know that in the 16th century, they considered the Dybbuk phenomenon to be the impregnation of the dead. Hello, hybridization program.
Yeah.
In the bodies of the living. And wouldn't you know that when the consciousness merged with the biological avatar that was in the womb, they took both of them at the same time.
I'm going to send this to you because I just found something on islamweb.net.
Okay.
About whether or not a woman can be impregnated by a jinn.
Interesting.
And
oh, yeah.
It brings up some interesting topic. You know, the minds cannot accept this matter since human and jinns are two completely different creatures. The nature of each one is totally different from the nature from the other. Human beings have body while jinn are only spiritual. The human beings are created from sounding clay, like the clay of pottery. Once again. There's that clay, while the jinns are created from a smokeless flame of fire. So mixing one kind with another is illogical, and breeding with this diversity is impossible. Therefore, we believe this woman who was pregnant from Xena, most probably she has committed this sin willingly and deliberately.
Yeah.
Once again, it's the fact of, could they do it? Not without full consent.
This is getting very deep.
Like so that, I can't believe I just found that on an Islamic site.
Yeah.
So yeah, I will send that to you because it goes again into the clay of creation, everything else, and the fact of the consent has to be there. It wouldn't naturally happen. By the laws of nature, it wouldn't happen.
Right.
And same thing by the laws of Hebrew nature, laws of angelic nature, everything else. It wouldn't happen without consent being there.
And they use different aspects and different mass to get us to that point. Now, here's something worth noting in Father Sinistrari's research. He was a Franciscan priest. He talks about the position, the phenomenon placed female victims then, and he would have discussions with them and their families, and they were basically at their wit's end, because in the Bible it seemingly there was no prohibition against having intercourse with whatever these women were having intercourse with. Like there wasn't they couldn't find it. And so going through these religious texts, and Sinistrari was thinking, okay, is it considered necrophilia?
Sure.
Or is it bestiality?
Or is it even necromancy?
I'm leaning towards that.
Necromancy. I would definitely lean toward necromancy, because at the very least, you are communing with the dead.
Yes,
especially when you're talking about this realm of spirit that you're talking about that is skipping generation to generation, which can really get into, especially whenever you start following Kabbalistic Judaism and Orthodox Judaism, the idea of the sins of the fathers, the idea of reincarnation within generation, where a soul skips a generation and comes back. And how that sin of the father is even carried through the familial bloodline.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. And we have this strange, strange happening where, for whatever reason, these beings want a material image of their apparitions. This gets, I mean, I'm telling you, when you look at the bloodline of this research, no pun intended, you see how it's interwoven, the concept of something deceased, something disembodied with a disability of being needs to replicate through the womb and through words. And both of those are combined. But getting back to this idea of the dead being re-embodied, it is necromancy. I mean, even when you get into literature written by, who was it, Montague Summers and Ashroy and other vampirologists, that there was this phenomenon of apparitions manifesting over the recently deceased and reanimating the body to harvest excretions. and then taking those excretions and implanting it into a woman to create a hybrid child. Now, guys, this is what troubles me about the whole hybrid mothership. I've spoken to many women about this. I've had to, and literally, I was put in a position one time to do marriage counseling because this phenomenon was attacking this woman and the husband didn't believe it. It was just a really unfortunate event. But here is the problem. History tells us that the first hybrids were created with the seed of dead men. So what are we dealing with? And it does speak of the afterlife. It speaks of the dead. And more than that, it speaks of esotericism and sorcery. It's not just seed from men. In one Witcher book, it talks about how it was the seed from hung men, like people who were murdered. And that's where the phenomenon went to first and then created a hybrid with the seed. It's troubling, but the deeper we get into this gloomy labyrinth, we see deception through and through, but for what purpose? And it does seem to be, and I'll conclude with it does seem to be the re-embodiment of the dead in the bodies of the living. And that is my working theory.
And it is an amazing hypothesis, Nathaniel. I have once again loved this idea since I first came across it, the idea that there is a working group of, and I wouldn't say it's not like it's some kind of spiritual Illuminati going on or anything like that. This, I don't think that, and maybe you can correct me, I don't think that there is an overarching plan by mm-hmm. these things. This is merely their means of survival. This, and I mean, you can pray for them in that way, folks, for the fact that this is how they have to subsist. They like, this is merely existence for them.
Exactly. Yes, this is a modus operandi.
Yeah, and it's not like it is an overarching plot for them to take over humanity in this way. It's not like it is an overarching plot for them to, come and inhabit the earth. They're mm-hmm. just literally like, this is how they are doomed to live.
Yes, sir. And it's impossible to look at the pathology of possession without realizing that there's the host and there's the parasite.
Yeah.
And the goal, the other day I was watching a biologist talk about
the willing host and the parasite. Now, don't get me wrong. Don't get me wrong, folks. There is, it's called demoniac possession. And it is mm-hmm. the point where there has to be some consent, but not full consent to possession. And I was there at one point in my life. Nathaniel, with my heavy and prolonged drug use, hard drug mm-hmm. use, to the point of, and this is what Malachi Martin spoke about so much in his work, was the idea of there is a point before full demonic possession, demoniac possession, where you have given over a part of your will mm-hmm. to something, be it alcohol, drug, lust, what have you. Mm-hmm. and you now make choices that are uncharacteristically you to feed them.
Right.
And
that's
I was
the
there.
Whole goal.
And I was there. And that is there. That is that Job moment that we were talking mm-hmm. about, where they are allowed to play with you without permission.
Correct.
They can do anything but kill you without permission. They play by a different set of rules. And they are allowed to play with you and toy with you without permission. Now, they could not. I would have had to give him permission for them to fully take me over. Thank God I was strong enough to fight as long as I did, and to be able to break that cycle. Now, is it the fact that things still poke at me? Yep. And that's warned about. That's warned about right here. Mm-hmm. If you are somebody who's gone through this right, you better get close to something bigger than you real quick. I don't care if it's the church, the tree next door, a dog, whatever. You better find your connection to what is bigger than you.
Absolutely.
And get close to it and love it. Because that thing knows your phone number now.
You
could change the phone number all day long. It knows the extension. Like, it'll get to you. It'll find its way back.
Yeah, it'll trace the trauma.
But,
and in my book, I talk about that. I talk about the hybridization program where these beings have walked the bridge of trauma and manifested through people. Now, absolutely. Something that I don't know how much longer we have, but
however long we got.
So what's been really interesting to me as of late, it's the Collins Elite. For those who don't know, the Collins Elite were a group of researchers from the Department of Defense. They were a private research group. They were not funded by the DOD, but they were a part of the DOD. And many of them, if not all of them, had evangelical, at least, religious backgrounds. And so they were trying to do what I'm doing. Probably did a better job, but they had more research doing it. I'm by myself. But anyways, they're trying to connect, trying to understand the interconnectivity between demonology and ufology and what we're really dealing with. But at the end of their research, their conclusion and what their conclusions led them to believe, it disturbs me. Number one, they believe that these beings were demons. And people are going to poo-poo on that. Well, just hear me out, guys.
Yep.
And that the phenomenon was masking itself as an alien. And they went to Sybil Leek, who was a contemporary to Crowley, Aleister Crowley. Mm-hmm. And they asked Sybil Leek to channel the beings that Crowley had contacted. And sure enough, she did. And they asked her, are you extraterrestrial? And the entity began to laugh at them. You fools, you idiots. This is just our newest mask. This is our newest deception is the word they used. But it was in their research that they believed that, of course, the phenomenon's a threat to us. These are what we would consider to be demonic in biblical antiquity. We are being deceived. But out of all of their conclusions, the one that haunts my mind because of the weight of it, but also like what would make them think this? They believed, and they all begin to practice this philosophy. They believe that we should keep the law of Moses in order to be saved from whatever these beings are. Now, my friend, I do not understand why they would say that. Why? What would bring them to that conclusion? Unless it was such an apocalyptic evil to where they reached all the way back to the Old Testament and said, "Hey, listen, we're gonna, like you said, we gotta cling to something that's larger than us because whatever's out there in the darkness is eclipsing everything we're about." Well, and so it's fascinating.
And what's really fascinating is to look at the drawings of Lamb.
Correct.
This is Lamb, folks. Everybody meet Lamb. Hey, Lamb. This is the entity that was Aleister Crowley's guide. This was his spirit guide, everything else. When you were talking about, they asked him to conjure the entity that he spoke to. This is him. Mm-hmm. Feel free to take a look at the characteristics. Very gray alien looking. Very gray alien in the way that it is. And once again, to think of, we just recently had Michael J.S. Carter on from Ancient Aliens, things like that, talking about the idea of Project Bluebeam. One of the things that, buddy, I mean, it wasn't even a red flag. It was like somebody shooting a flare in the air at MUFON. That happened this year. I mean, to the point, Nathaniel, where I did not air an interview.
Ooh.
And I've spoken with the good man before. He's got some interesting topics. But things got too straight biblical at one point with somebody's experience. And it came to the words of, well, I can't really, I'd love to talk with you about what your experience is, but really that's for me to take up with the man of your house because he's the one in charge of the spirituality there. It was like, yo.
Who said that?
No, I won't say names on air. I won't do that. I'll tell you privately, but I won't say it on air. And it was like, wow, man, no, you can't. I'm not going to allow you to use somebody's experience spiritually against them in that way. No,
that's wild.
I won't. It was rough, dude. It was rough.
Had to have been.
But I saw at that moment, my man, because I've talked with him before, and I've talked with many, many Christians, many Bible-loving, God-fearing Christians, who this is demonic to them. This is demonic in source, that the idea of UFOs and everything fully, and hey, I did a whole report on UFOs in the Bible and the wheel of Ezekiel in 10th grade, like in a secular school, a teacher let me do that. But yeah, that was wild. And I had a lot of people thinking, you know, and when you start looking at the Bible in this way and you start looking at it as a confirmation of these things, yeah, there's a lot there. But could it possibly be used as the means by which to catalyze an entire group of thought in the world into action? Scarily enough, yes. Scarily 100%. Enough, yes, 100%. You know, if you make that an entrenched part of their religious belief,
I agree with that. Yeah.
And we have to be wary of that. We have to be wary of all of these things because they are a form of deception. Nathaniel.
Yes.
And you can take that in a biblical way if you want, folks. I'm just talking about it being a form of deception, period. I'm talking about it being something that infiltrates communities and tears them apart philosophically and ontologically. And as a means by which that, you know, I mean, heck, even Facebook, whenever it got its first round of funding from InQtel, like not many people realize that there is a financial arm of the CIA called InQtel that is out there that finds all kinds of burgeoning technologies. Like, they never did find that guy whose account just said, hey, I'm tired of Hosni Mubarak. Let's all meet and have an Arab Spring in the middle of the city square. An entire government was overthrown because of a Facebook post.
That's wild.
People have forgotten.
That's wild.
You know, and that's how easy it is to use this kind of platform for a different use.
Yes, propaganda.
That's how easy it is to propagandize something or sensationalize something to the point that it is fully absorbed by a group of people. Or that it is fully used to, because we all want that want of confirmation, Nathaniel. We all want that want that we all have that want that what we believe is, and that other people believe it too.
Right, right. The communion aspect of it and everything. I got to get out of here in about 5 minutes.
Yeah, man. Absolutely.
I just got a text message.
No worries.
But
no worries.
But yeah, you're right. And I think that's where we're at in the field, you know. And I try to be very inclusive in my research.
Same.
I don't believe – now, getting back to this – that's what I'm going to say. Yeah. Getting back to this parasitic aspect of the phenomenon. Well, are they a threat? Well, and here's how – and I'm just going to say it. Here's how lazy some of the theory is now, where, okay, well, if they're such a threat, why don't they kill us all? Well, okay. It's only kind of one entity that would do that, or, you know, it's not like, okay, they're a bear or a lion.
Killing you is not good for the long game.
Right, because they didn't need us to self-replicate. Which anybody, like I said, with the cursory knowledge of the phenomenon, even throughout history, yes, that's what they've done. And so if we're looking at a parasitic entity, which I believe it is, you know, there's the possessor, then there's the possessed, the host, and the parasite itself.
Yep.
The goal of the parasite is not to kill the host. How ludicrous is it to hear that from people? Well, they just want to kill us. Yeah. Okay. What their goal is, okay, as long as the host survives, so do I. This is the nature of it all, man. I'm getting – and I'll, look, so when you get into the pathology of possession and pregnancy, the hybridization program, creating biological avatars, then you see the esoteric nature of it all. I mean, my God, I have a – there's a ritual in Mesopotamia called the Red Rite. where this is, it's not just Mesopotamia. It's also in recent history in different cultures, but originated in Mesopotamia, where a magician, a sorcerer, I'm not talking about the guy that puts your groceries away at Kroger. I'm talking, and I'm not even talking about the guy that does podcasts, right? Does interviews. I'm talking about the guy we have no idea exists doing what he does in the dark, the darkness of ambiguity and anonymity. Anyways, what he would do is when his body started to die, he would go and inseminate a woman. Hello, incubus.
Yeah.
Right. It's right in front of us. And then he would dispossess his body, place his consciousness into that fetus. Now he has a new body. So look what has to occur for us as a species to facilitate that self-replication method. There has to be an egg. Hello. There has to be a woman. Hello. She has to be fertile. They monitor their fertility. There has to be seed taken from a man or coming from a man. There was. Then there has to be a fetus. There is. And then there has to be consciousness in that fetus. All of this is the same action. We've just compartmentalized it into the incubi, hybridization program. Oh, that's abduction. No. We've seen this over and over again. And even in The Golden Bough by James Frazier, he talks about this phenomenon. He talks about soldiers or warriors or Gibborim, Hebrew scholars, Gibborim, who when they were on the battlefield, if they were mortally wounded, they would dispossess their own body and place their consciousness in someone else.
Wow.
We know that as possession. But we've only known possession through a certain lens of theology.
That's
what
right.
We didn't realize was the man. Now I'm getting passionate. There's like the big finale, I guess. You know, now we're realizing that this is a method.
Yeah.
Where Malachi Martin calls it perfect possession. What do you mean? What we mean is now that parasite has a host. And even in the pathology of possession, the goal eventually was to create the host in the parasite's image.
Yep.
And I'll shut up.
Yeah.
Yeah, man. But I think it's fascinating stuff. Man. Fascinating.
It is absolutely fascinating. And it is one of those that once again flies in the face of what I would be considered traditional demonology. I do not think, I mean, traditional demonology definitely has the idea of the incubus succubus, but this goes so far beyond that. And the idea of a realm of spirits that are disembodied, that need a body, need a corporeal form to live, need that energy to exist.
The image of the invisible, my friend.
Yeah, absolutely. Phenomenal work, man. I love this stuff. Once again,
Thank you, brother. You're welcome
on again and again and again. Before we let you go, let everybody know where they can go to get your books, where they can go to keep up with your work, follow you. Any new appearances coming up, things like that. Let us know all of this.
Oh, man. Yeah, well, I don't – I took September off, and I've already done – I think 7 or 8 interviews this month, and it's only the 9th. So I've done a full month of shows already in the last week and a half. So I don't know what I'm going to do. I might reschedule some shows. I don't know. But you can. I'm on YouTube and I am on Instagram. I'm not on Facebook or Twitter. I don't like UFO Twitter. I just don't like the whole vibe of it. Not against people that have accounts. It's just I just don't like the vibe. Yeah. But that's where you can find me. And for those who are more interested in my research, you can go to my YouTube channel. And in my playlist selection, I have a playlist full of my guest appearances. I think it's near 100 that's just on YouTube. But if you guys are interested in my recent Coast to Coast interview, you can find it on the Coast to Coast page. And bro, you know I love you like a brother, man, and I'm still trying to find a Mai Tai somewhere here in Dayton. maybe even try that today.
I'll send you some recipes today, bud. How about that?
Okay, that sounds good, buddy.
And as always, folks, you can find Nathaniel's work. We embed, there he is right there. I knew you were on our videos page.
Yes,
we
sir.
Embed all of our guest video channels right there on our videos page. CuriousRealm.com/videos is where you can go to follow all of our guests. You can also find all of their works at CuriousRealm.com/store. That is where you can go to buy all of the books from our guests. That's where you can go to buy Curious Realm swag, all the things, all the tools that we talk about on air, everything else. Nathaniel, thank you so much for the time for this incredible 100th episode. It's so awesome to have come this far with the show already. I cannot wait to do 1,000 until I have to just stop putting episode numbers. As of right now, we are almost in competition with Dudes and Beer, my former incarnation, with time. I know Dudes and Beer, awesome. I think you can listen to for 33 days straight and not hear the same content.
Wow.
We are that's creeping up on that with Curious Realm with all of our live coverage, everything else. So,
congrats,
thank you for being a part of all of that. Thank you for always being there whenever I call. Thank you for the amazing research and the awesome, awesome conversation as always, my friend. Godspeed with all that you do and with all of your research. While you're online checking him out, folks, make sure to stop on by CuriousRealm.com. That is where you can like, follow, subscribe, everything else. When we come back from this commercial break, we will be joined by the amazing Bishop James Cloud. We will be talking about the world of the exorcist, what it is to be an exorcist. We will be dispelling myths as well as getting into cases of demonic possession when we come back from this commercial break right after this, folks. Well, hello, everybody, and welcome back from that commercial break. Thank you to all of our sponsors, especially Webworks Wireless. You guys have been with us since our rebrand into Curious Realm, and it is because of you guys that we have our live web stream every week on CuriousRealm.com. It is because of you guys that we are able to go out and do the live streaming that we do from events, everything else. So thank you so much. Webworks Wireless, webworkswireless.com is your home for unthrottled, no credit check wireless for your home, camper, excursion vehicles, what have you. On the line tonight, during our second part, we have with us our good friend, Archbishop James Cloud. He is not only an exorcist, but he is the author of Walking with Ghosts, an exorcist memoir into the paranormal. Our whole episode tonight is dedicated to the other side. I'm often asked what our intro, what our outro means, you know, whenever I say the other side is always watching. That's E Pluribus Unum, other side, folks. That is the other side of the government. That is the other side of your local community. That you may belong to on social media. It is the other side of the coin. It is the other side of the universe, the yang to your yin. Whatever you want to interpret that as, there is always another side watching. And the other side that we have devoted tonight to is demons, evil spirits. We spoke in the first part about demon seeding and the idea that there is a spiritual essence out there that is not just fully demon or angelic, but is part demon, part man, and needs that flesh to continue, and is thus using us as a seed base to continue its life, and is frequently the form of somnambular form possession that you may see places across the globe. And that is what brings us. We spoke about that with Nathaniel Gillis, our good friend, for the first couple hours. And that is what brings us to our second part, talking about exorcism with our good friend and exorcist, Archbishop James Cloud. Welcome, as always, good father. How are you?
Thank you. I'm doing fine as frog hair.
Hot diggity, man. You can't hop better than that.
And nope.
You know, all joking aside, this is a topic that is near and dear to my heart, exorcism is something that it fascinated me when I, as I entered the seminary, as I went to enter the seminary, The Exorcist had always been a favorite movie of mine for other reasons, but specifically the rite of exorcism and the exorcism of demonic spirits from sick people, from people who mm-hmm. have been oppressed by these is fascinating to me and goes back way far back in history to, I mean, even Mesopotamia, things like that. So let's start getting into a little bit of exorcismic history and what brings us to the rite that we know today, because even the rite that you practice is pretty well the Roman ritual. But there are variegations and variations on the ritual across the globe. And it's interesting to me to see non-consecrated exorcising demons, things like that. And we'll get into some mm-hmm. of that later on, but let's start off with a little bit of history and where the practice of exorcism as practiced now comes from, Father.
Sure. Well, like you said, you know, every culture, every ancient culture has always had a form of exorcism. I mean, you go back to Babylon, Mesopotamia, whatnot. I mean, we still have records of exorcisms being performed, what they said and how they did it. But when you look at going back into Judaism, you had the idea of the scapegoat and on the Day of Atonement, one lamb was slaughtered to cover the sins of the Jewish people. The other was let out into the wilderness that had sin from the people to be part of Azazel, if memory serves. I believe it was Azazel. And really, that was a form of exorcism. It was exorcising the sins of the people, throwing it onto the scapegoat, and off it went. You have Jewish rabbis that have performed exorcisms in the past. And of course, as Christians, we're really Jews, just that we believe in the Jewish Messiah,
absolutely,
whether we're Jew or Gentile. And of course, our tradition of exorcism follows Christ's own ministry. That was really, when you put the numbers together, it's about 75% of his ministry was exorcism.
Yes.
And the ironic thing in this day and age, many clergy don't even believe in it.
Okay,
those ordained.
That is a part of what we just got done talking about. I recently had the conversation with a very good friend of mine, Michael Rea, about this. And hey, Michael, if you're out there listening, and Father Jonathan, his older brother, if you're out there listening, I myself had a departure from my faith, from my church.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. Because there was nothing in the big green book that explained what happened to me. There was this. I had the Roman ritual.
Mm-hmm.
I know what that says. But it doesn't really say a whole lot in that catechism about demons, demonology, evil spirits, despite the fact of, you know, we read a lot of Paul. We read a lot about evil things lurking after our souls around every corner. We see it depicted in all kinds of artwork about St. Augustine and, you know, things like that. But when it comes to actually dealing with it, like you said, there's very few that would take it as that. Like I consider myself fortunate for the ecstatic experience I had. Mm-hmm. To have had an open-minded and open-hearted priest. That when I took that ecstatic experience at the altar to them, they were like, Chris, you should really explore that. Like, they knew me. They knew that this wasn't some spurious thing that just happened or some whim of fancy. You know, like, we had served together for years. They knew me well. We had had numerous conversations And yeah, fortunately, I had a very experienced priest that was like, you should explore that thought of service. You should consider that.
Yeah.
But when it came to that, I don't know any of them that were like, ooh, wow, you know, we should explore that a little bit, man, and try mm-hmm. to find you some answers.
Yeah.
Most didn't shy away. They straight turned away.
Absolutely, they do. Yeah. Yeah, and it's not just Rome, you know. Mm. You've got the same issues in the evangelical churches. Of course, most of them are just pop psychology and cognitive behavioral therapy wrapped in Christianese. But I can't tell you how many cases that have come to me in the past, and I interview the individuals that are experiencing a haunting or a possession or, you know, whatever the case may be. And they say, well, we've went to all the churches in our area, including the Roman Catholic Church, and they all turn us away or just say, well, you know, it's just a psychological thing. You just need to deal with it. And it always amazes me how they can say something psychological when doors are opening and closing on their own, cupboards slapping shut and slapping open, and they're seeing the shadow people that are interacting. They got video and audio evidence of these things. You know, in the psychological world, if everything is just happening in the mind of the individual, well, we could probably rule that as a psychotic episode of some sort. You know, they're in a psychosis. Sure.
Well, and let's start because sure. Yes, you that is your background. That is your degree.
Absolutely.
Like, you are a psychologist. You are a social worker. Like, this is the first place you go is there.
Yep. I look at first, is it mental health? Second, is it substance induced? Hmm. You know, are they having a meth induced psychosis or a hallucinogenic
withdrawal hallucinations, issue? What have you?
Yep. Absolutely.
Yeah.
And I have to sit down with them for quite a while and go through both of those things because I'm qualified to diagnose mental health issues as well as substance abuse issues.
Yep.
And so, you know, once I can rule those things out, then I can say, okay, well, let's then look at what's happening, and then we can go from there. Of course, that doesn't mean I also don't refer them out to therapy because they're experiencing some traumatic things and they need someone to talk to for that. Sure. But once you rule out the explainable, all you're left with is the unexplainable.
Yeah.
And there's been a lot of cases where it was mental health or it was a, you know, they were just fresh, clean off of a substance that could induce a hallucinatory effect. But then you have the other cases that are true. I mean, it's happening as they're saying, you know.
Well,
especially when you see kids and adults getting hit, beat, scratched right in front of you.
Yeah. Yeah. And right here, part three from page 169 of Exorcism of the Possessed. This is from the English side, not the Latin. You would not want to hear me butcher ecclesiastic Latin. especially he should not believe in this. He, in this point, is the exorcist. This is all instructions for the exorcist, folks, on how to identify somebody. He should not believe too readily that a person is possessed by an evil spirit, but he ought to ascertain the signs by which a possessed person might be distinguished from one who is suffering from melancholy or some other illness. Signs of possession are the following: ability to speak with some facility in a strange tongue or to understand it when spoken by another, the facility of divulging future and hidden events, display of powers which are beyond the subject's age and natural condition, and various other indications which, when taken together as a whole, pile up the evidence. So like you said, to going to the going past the point of psychological examination. That's step number one. Let's make sure that nobody's having a psychotic break. Let's make sure that nobody's having the rare case of schizophrenia. Yes, everybody's schizophrenia exists, but you are talking like one in a thousand people, if not more than that. And within those who are within a, say, schizophrenic, you know, you're talking maybe 1 in 100 of those are actual schizophrenics. It is an extraordinarily and exceedingly rare mental disorder, not like people think it is.
And people will often say a person with multiple personalities is a schizophrenic, which usually isn't the case. It's a totally different disorder called dissociative identity disorder. And you got to differentiate that from possession.
Well, and that is where those other means come from. Once again, knowing languages that you aren't aware of, speaking in languages or responding to languages, even in your native tongue, understanding them. Things like that, things like strength beyond that of their age or size, which once again could be attributed to some sort of drug-induced psychosis. But those are answerable means once again. Now, what are some of the cases of extreme uncture, as they would be referred to later in that same book, now you've got something that is what they consider a case of extreme uncture. Like it. Okay. We've gone through all these steps. We've hit step 8 now. We have a case. How do you go about getting to that point, Archbishop?
Well, once I've, dismissed all the explainable, then I get into work mode, doing what I do. One of the things is I make sure if it's a person that's being exercised, I have loved ones there assisting me. I have usually one or two other assistants that are also praying with me, because I never do it alone. I mean, that's a big no-no for one. But two, it's dangerous doing it alone. Just like the scripture says, a cord of three can't be broken. I typically bring at least two others with me when it comes to an exorcism. And then, of course, adding into the loved ones and whatnot, because one, I'm always consciously aware that the person is being traumatized the entire time that this thing, this cretin, is inside them and manipulating them and doing everything else. One thing I have to establish out of the gate is the authority in Christ over these things, because they'll do every slippery way they can to either make you doubt, bring up past sins if they're unconfessed. And that brings into my preparation. I usually fast 2 or 3 days prior. I confess my sins. I get myself ready for spiritual battle, because I can't fight these things on my own. It's only through the blood of Christ can I do that. And so you prepare, you get them safe and secure as best as you can. Most of the, I have yet to have to restrain any of them. Usually. Yeah. And that's kind of a Hollywood thing to a degree. There's some that are exceedingly violent and you have to, but by and large, the demons, they'll say, "Oh, I'm Lucifer. I'm Beelzebub. I'm this, I'm that." And it's usually, some little podunk demon that's just aggrandizing itself to scare, put in, doubts and, you name it, whatever it can do, it'll do.
Well, and that was part of what we were just talking about with our previous guest, is you think this thing wants to kill you. It doesn't want to kill you. It's got a willing host. Do you realize how hard it is to find a willing host?
Yeah.
Like, the demon in possessing the person doesn't want them physically harmed. It doesn't want to kill them.
Yeah.
If it killed them, then they would be free. And they don't want to be free. They want to be in something. They want to feel.
Oh, yeah. And they love the torment that they can put on the person.
Yeah.
Yeah. And destroy the family is, you know. But the thing that they... The ultimate aim, and this is something I always tell everyone that I deal with on a case, is the ultimate aim of any demon, the biggest end game is suicide. You know, once they're done playing, they hop to the next person, but they want to have that person commit suicide. But the end game beyond that is ruination. You know, they want to hang around as long as they can to destroy a person's finances, relationships, or anything that you can, mental health. I mean, really anything to really ruin that individual.
Well, because through the ruin of that individual, they get to tenderly ruin the ones around them.
Absolutely.
They get to weaken and corrupt them as well.
Sure. And then they can jump to them.
And if any of them are in that narrow occasion of sin, it makes them so easier to get to. And that was part of what we just discussed, was that these things play by a different set of rules. We are given very specific rules spiritually by which we are to rule and run this world. However, the last set of rules they were given was don't kill them.
Mm-hmm.
That was pretty much it. Torment them, take everything away from them, destroy their crops, whatever you want.
Yep.
Just don't kill
like
them.
Job.
Just don't kill them. You know? And that's just it. They're playing by a different set of rules cosmically than we are. So even to think that, would it be correct to say how many folks, have you had to perform the rite on that were not of any religious affiliation? Zero.
Yeah. I don't think there's one that was actually possessed. Now, a ton of hauntings where they infest the home, but not possession. They want to ruin that person's faith.
Yeah. Yeah. Which is what I'm bringing up. The idea that, where God is, they want to be. God, that just brought into a Christian song in my head in a horribly twisted way. For where I am, there you may also be. Like, I just got the creepers. but in all sincerity, it's true. That is what they want to corrupt. They want to corrupt the one thing that they don't have. They do not have salvific grace. They don't have a soul.
No.
And
the other thing that they do, they know they can't hurt God. They tried that once and failed miserably. And so the next best thing to hurt God is to hurt the ones that he loves. And that's their proxy war they have with God. You know, that they torment and torture the people that God loves, you know, because we're created in his image. They weren't. We are.
Yeah, we were breathed life into. They were just snapped into being.
Yeah. Yeah, God took time to fashion us from the earth. I mean, even the name of the first man, Adam, means red dirt in the Hebrew.
Yeah.
You know, and of course, that's also why we have to have vitamins, minerals, everything else to keep us going, because we're made from the earth.
Yeah.
It's just, you know, people don't see the bigger picture on the reasons why these things do what they do. And I tell you what, if they can mess with a person, they're happy to do it. But at some level, that person has also allowed them an entryway.
Let's get into that real quick. Because, I mean, I won't lie, like sitting right here on my desk from our previous conversation is still Pazuzu, African God of the West Wind.
Okay.
But, you know, like I said, fan of the movie Exorcist.
Sure.
But at the same token, I don't have any Ouija boards in my house. I don't have anything like that. I am a huge believer in it is the intent of something. And whether that is my intent or not, the intent of that item is that.
Sure.
You know, so I don't want one in my house. That's just me. Like yeah. any fans, you want to send me a Ouija board, you know, maybe I'll take a plectrum from it, but not a, you know, not the actual board itself. That's just where I stand. Now, how do people begin opening these doors, so to speak? Because it doesn't necessarily take a knock on the window or you turning yourself away from a religion that you follow on the daily to be opening this door, correct?
Correct. Yeah, in the broadest way and the broadest word that a person opens himself up for any type of demonic, you know, shall we say, intervention in their life is sin. But so, like the old word for sorcery, I think I've said it before on here, you know, is pharmakeia.
Yep.
Which is drug use, you know, using psychoactive substances to reach a spiritual enlightenment or something. You know, I can't tell you how many times I've heard people that have used DMT, and there's these spiritual beings in there that either are really nice or really not nice. Mm. And, you know, you got LSD that can do something similar. I mean, you tweak out and, you know, zone out and see, go on a trip. But they're even, you know, raging alcoholism can do it. Anything.
Absolutely.
You know, or that one of the obvious things is dabbling with the occult. You know, people, and over the years, I figured out what that's really about for folks. You know, in a world where chaos reigns, using spells, incantations, what have you, it's a way to gain personal power or personal control over their
sure.
microcosm environment.
Sure.
And unfortunately, they forget that it's God that's in control. But they want to do things their way, which was exactly the sin of Lucifer. And so, unfortunately, that opens them up to it. Now, not everyone that messes with a Ouija board or does drugs or anything else
absolutely.
Will get a, you know, it's a matter of availability of what things are around you, demonic spirits, I should say. But also, are you already on that dark path and they don't really need to mess with you? They just need to make you feel good that you're dabbling in dark things. And you take your attention off of the creator and put it on the creation.
Yeah.
That's really the biggest piece when it comes to that. Yeah, but of course, some openly invite it. Or they send, like, I've had several cases where people have summoned friendly entities to go and protect a family member. Well, the things they summoned, well, they weren't friendly, and they totally jacked up that other person's life or home.
Yeah.
You know, but there's a myriad of ways that one can open themselves up. I mean, if you're in open sin, basically giving God the finger, even if you were raised in church, you don't have the protection of the Holy Spirit because you are, you know, you're doing your thing. You're in rebellion.
Sure.
And demons love a rebellious spirit.
And
so they go for it.
And once again, that just means the real simple rule is, folks, don't be a dink.
Yeah.
Like, you don't have to go to church on Sunday. You don't have to go to Bible study on Wednesday. You don't have to wear a yarmulke on Friday. None of that action. You just have to literally be a human being to other human beings and not be a dink.
Yeah.
Like, there's no great, yeah, I'd love to say that there's some great, huge revelation. Don't get me wrong. I am fully with anybody as well, you know, and my audience. If you are a Bible going Christian, go with your Bible, man. If you bow to the East every few hours, go bow to the East, man. Do what is right by you and what is right by the world with you, you know? That's where we're supposed to be. That's where God wants us to be. I don't think he cares who's right, who's wrong, so to speak. There is a universal capital T truth right that we're all supposed to be participating in. And that is spoken through the language of love and where sin is brought in. You know when you've sinned, you know when you've done something bad, you know when you have done something to betray your fellow man and humanity. That is what you're warning against. And we all have that capacity, despite any religion, to know this.
And of course, you know, as a Christian bishop, I would also add in there, you know, that when Christ was on the earth, he says, "I'm the way, the truth, and the life. No Absolutely. One comes to the Father except through me." And in my religious beliefs and in everything I hold dear, Christ is the truth. There is no other truth.
Yeah.
Others are flashlights where the Son of God is literally the sun, you know, shining its brilliance on anything and everything, and that's what makes the shadows go away, because all a shadow is the absence of light. So for me, that's what I would add to that. Absolutely. You know, that Christ is the way.
Well, and that brings us to a very big point, and a point that, you know, I will argue with people all day long about exorcism.
Sure.
Do I believe that every Christian has a means by which to bring another person into Christ? Sure. I don't think it takes anything more than a couple few believers gathered together and bringing somebody into the world of Christ through baptism. However, I would take a far, far swing different opinion when it comes to can anybody that has been anointed as a Christian perform an exorcism? I'm of the mind no. That's just me. I do know, but that's because I know what this book, at least by my faith, says somebody's supposed to have in order to fight that battle. And I know I ain't got it. I would have loved to have had it. Don't get me wrong. That was one of the pads I wanted when I wanted the collar, Father. And I was definitely called to the ministry of reconciliation, which is where exorcism lies in the church. It is under the seal of confession. And rightfully so. But I do not think. I don't even think that the average person could sit in a confessional for a Saturday and walk out the same person. Much less witness the first flinging moments of an exorcismic ceremony without fleeing in fear.
Yeah. And unfortunately, a lot of clergy do the same thing. That's a sad thing. I've heard many priests that have ran away from an exorcism. As soon as they've seen something that they weren't used to, they were gone.
Well,
left that person to suffer.
I can imagine that you see a lot. We've never really gotten into how many. I know you've done numerous deliverances. I know you have done numerous deliverances of homes from hauntings, things like that. To know what it is going in is totally different than to be confronted with it.
Sure. Absolutely.
And that's no different than any soldier that's gone through boot camp and then 3-6 months later is thrown into an actual battlefield.
Yeah.
You know, they could prepare you for that all day long in exorcism school at the seminary, if that is where they take you, which, hey, you know, the church has reopened the school of exorcism.
We actually have 3 or 4 of them now, I believe.
Yeah, there is one here in the United States now. So yeah, like it's out there. It's a thing. And finally the church has started saying that we have been way too long overdue with this, and talking about it and confronting it, and actively doing battle with it, because it is something that once it's there, it's there. It never goes away. That is one of the big things that is there in the ritual, is that if you aren't close to something bigger than you, even in the AA way of something bigger than you, after that experience, you need to get close to something real quick.
Yeah.
Don't care if it's the church, whatever. You find some kind of spiritual base in your life, and you find it now. How long do you keep in touch with somebody after they've gone through the rite?
As long as they need me. As long as they need me. Because my background is in psychology as well, I'm there to also counsel them and to equip them to be able to deal with the after effects. Because that's a thing that isn't talked about too often, is the after effects of a possession, even a haunting.
Let's go into that for a minute, because that is one of the things that we talk all the time about on this show, is the lingering effects and what it can do to you.
Sure. You know, one of the most common things is heightened anxiety for a very long time after such things. You know, usually one of my first advisements to a family that, one, just bringing it down to just a typical haunting, is not to talk about it once the house is cleared, not to glorify it, not to spread it around, not to seek, you know, YouTube fame or something else on it, but to leave the past in the past. Because as soon as these people start glorifying it or try to be YouTube famous, these things are like, well, they're wanting me back, obviously.
Yeah.
Letting me back in because they think it was the greatest thing since sliced bread, you know?
Yeah, you just left the window open after you shut the door.
Exactly. So I tell the folks, one, don't talk about it. You know, leave it. Let dead dogs lie. And just try to move on. But the things they'll experience, you know, heightened anxiety, sometimes depression. One of the things that, you know, it's a weird to say this, but a lot of the people that have had a long-term haunting or obsession, oppression or possession, is that they miss it to a certain degree because it made them feel special. Even though it was hellish to go through, it also did something for their pride, because at some level, it's like, hey, this thing, and, you know, they don't literally say this, but their behaviors say this, you know, it made me feel special. It made me feel unique. I was the one that was haunted. And that plays into the, you know, YouTube famous and everything else.
Sure.
And of course, that's opening it right back up. Well, that's something we need to deal with.
Well, and especially when you brought up something very interesting in that listing of shuns, including oppression and demoniac oppression. And we've talked about this on the show before. We talked about it in the previous segment. The idea of, and as Father Malachi Martin would put it, it was the state just before demoniac obsession. before you had fully given your will over, you had given your will over to something else. That fulfilled something inside of you. And in exchange for that, you did things that were uncharacteristic of you. Things like, for instance, an addict will begin stealing when they've never stolen before.
Got to feed the addiction.
So things like that. And yes, you know, like I have been to the point of obsession like that in my life where I have been right there, dangerously. And it's scary because there is a point, and I approach all of it with huge, huge empathy that I did not used to, because there does come a point where you're fighting.
Yep.
Where you are fighting. I don't care if it's depression, what have you, where you are gasping for air and doing everything you can to come out of that.
Yep.
And God bless you if you do. And God bless you if you need the strength to come out of that, people. Because it is not easy. It's not easy. But it can be done.
And I would encourage folks to ask for help.
Yes.
You know, you're... Literally, one of the things that these influences do too is they make you think that you're all alone. They'll influence you to separate yourself from your natural supports of family, friends, loved ones. You go, oh, I can't talk about it. You know, no one would understand. And of course, they're whispering in your ear, hey, no one would understand anyway. You know, you brought this on yourself, et cetera, et cetera. Why are you bothering other people with this? Blah, blah, blah. And help is out there. You know, if it's just starting with the, because they will affect mental health, anxiety, depression, whatever.
Yeah.
You know, talk to someone. Talk to a therapist, work through it, find a religious figure to speak with, one that would actually listen instead of just poo-poo you. But seek help, because it's out there and you're not alone.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And once again, the way our society is right now doesn't really account for a lot of this toying from the outside, so to speak. Which a lot of it is and can be, you know. And it can be hard, especially if your demon is addiction, anything. And don't get me wrong, folks, you can be addicted to depression just as easily as cocaine, no doubt. It's hard to break those cycles. It's hard to get past those cycles, and it can be hard to really find a path to help outside of yourself. What can people do to, I guess, have that self-resilience and to learn to find the help that they need? What first steps can they have, Father?
Well, I think the first step, you know, just pragmatically, is finding out you're not alone in the struggle. Other people struggle with it too. You know, whether it's addiction, mental health, actual demonic influence, you're not alone. People, you know, put on these masks in society, and they just put on the happy, especially in churches. Churches are really notorious for it. You know, they go to church on Sunday and everyone's happy. It looks like everyone has the perfect life. But in reality, everyone's struggling. People will struggle with temptation. People struggle with sin. People struggle with mental health. People struggle with addictions. And, you know, everyone's addicted to something. Just some things are more beneficial than others. You know, whether you're addicted to sports, and I'm not saying these are the things that open you to self to demonic influence. I'm not saying that, but just so that folks have empathy for those that do have some of the harder addictions. Some people are addicted to shopping. Some people are addicted to sex or gambling. Relationships, gambling. Yeah, that's a massive one. You know, so everyone's struggling and addicted to something. So the first step is realizing you're not alone in your struggles. There are people that do understand, and they might be struggling with the exact same thing. Yeah. And might be a resource if they've been able to work past that.
And before we started our conversation today, we were talking about kids, listening to kids, yeah. especially when it came to things like this. I once again had a very open-minded mother. Fortunately, I remember there being times in my life where something was there. I don't know what mm-hmm. it was, but it was there. How do we talk to our kids about these things? How do we even if you don't come from a dogmatic upbringing, it doesn't mean that you can't help educate your children to beware when their belly tells them something's wrong.
Yeah.
Come tell mom and dad. Don't be afraid to come talk to mom and dad. Mom and dad aren't going to make fun of you because of what you see, hear, feel, anything like mm-hmm. that. How can we start to open that conversation with our children?
The biggest thing is to forming open and communicative relationships. You know, a lot of parents in this society poo-poo anything a kid would say, but it's been my experience that kids are very truthful when they're trying to explain, hey, such and such happened, or, you know, this happened or that happened, or this person was touching me weird, it made me feel weird, or, I mean, parents have to listen to the children first and foremost.
Yep.
And like with my own children, you know, they know that they can ask me any question and I will tell them truthfully the answer, whether it's a pleasant truth or if it's an inconvenient truth, let's put it that way.
Yeah.
But I put it in terms that they can understand. You know, I'm not going to bust out my theology book and talk high theology with a 6 and 9 year old.
Yeah. Yeah. There's no reason to get into an epistemologic argument.
Exactly. You know, but I'm going to say that there are bad things in this world. There are bad people in this world. And you can't trust everyone. Not everyone is on your side. Not everyone wants the best for you. And you have to stand up for yourself. And if you need help, you ask mom or dad.
Yeah.
And, you know, for instance, with one thing I tell my kids, you know, they'll ask me, have you fought ghosts? Or, you know, they put it in kids' terms, of course. And I go, yeah, daddy's helped a lot of people with people that have ghosts or there's something bad inside them that only I can get out because no one else wants to do it. Mm. And I explain, you know, there is a devil. But God is in control, and you never have to be afraid of the devil because the devil's already been beat. You just have to remind the devil that he's been beat. You know, they laugh and they go, how do you do that? I say, in Jesus' name, you rebuke him. You get it on out, and you'll see that it does leave. Mm. But, you know, I don't tell them the intricate, frightening details of every little thing. But I'm also going to be equipping them, you know, even though they're very young, yep. I equip them with the knowledge they need to be able to fight spiritual battles if they need to. And, you know, I don't say demons are everywhere and, you know, oh, the darkness is going to eat them up and they're going to get you, pull you off the bed at night or something like that. But I let them know the world isn't roses and candy bars, you know. The world is good, it's bad, and it's everything in between. And when the inevitable topics of sex and stuff come up, I'll be very honest with them.
Yeah.
You know, again, I'll put it in terms I understand. I won't do like my my grandmother told my mom and said, oh, don't get around boys.
Yeah.
They'll get you pregnant.
Yep.
And she's like, huh? What do you mean?
Yeah, that's it. That's the end of the conversation. Like,
yeah,
like on King of the Hill. I was given a book about flowers. That's
okay,
it.
Okay, here's the pestle, here's the pollen.
Yeah.
And
the book was like my body, the beautiful flower, or something like that. That's how she learned about her body. And yes, I used to actually teach a weekend class with seventh graders, sex and sexuality, and understanding that in the world around you as you get older and your place in that. And the pressures that come along with that. And good God, man, that was like 1999. I cannot imagine what that course would be now. And what the life lessons would be now. Because it can be hard and uncomfortable to broach these topics, especially with kids. But believe it or not, folks, if you pay attention, they're broaching them for you.
Absolutely.
You ain't going to have to broach it. You ain't going to have to or wonder when it's going to be broached. Like, it will happen. The question is, are you ready to respond? And do you have a response in chamber? You know,
exactly.
And when it comes to these things, I listen to my son keenly, because, I believe that there is a cutoff where the real world just kind of settles in about 8 or 9. Most kids, where imagination time kind of stops.
Yeah.
You know, the voices in your head go into your head. They're no longer an external dialogue.
Yeah.
You know, and I don't know. I'm trying not to crush that in my son as much as possible because it helps in a lot of ways. And it's strange to me that the world does want to get rid of that so fast, so fast.
They do. They do.
And it can serve us so well if tapped into properly, Father.
Well, and the reality is it's the destruction of innocence.
Yeah.
For some reason, they do not want kids to be kids. You know, they want them to parentify them or make them an adult way early. And
yeah.
It's a disservice and it really messes those kids up into the future.
Mm. Yeah. Man, thank you so much for coming on. You always come on. We have such amazing conversations about such a deep, hard topic, you know, the idea of exorcism and even the idea of, you know, looking at your family members who may be suffering from an obsession in a different way. Even if it does that for me, this is useful and amazing because we are surrounded by this all the time. I am no longer, we've had the conversation privately. I have it on the show. I am no longer a church going Catholic. I do not step foot into a sanctuary every Sunday, things like that. I speak with my God every day. I believe I am stronger in my faith than I have ever been with my God. Despite that, I should probably get to some church at some point, but
you should.
But I think I want that more for my service. I miss some of my service that I did with my knights, you know.
Sure.
I miss some of the good things that I did in the community. I miss some of the things like teaching, like what I do with this show. You know, and dispelling things that are total misbeliefs and total misconceptions.
And don't forget the Eucharist.
Absolutely. The miracle of the Eucharist is always there.
Absolutely.
And you know, the truths you bring to this show are amazing. Thank you so much for your time, as always, Father.
Oh, you're very welcome. I'm happy to do it.
Well, let everybody know where they can go to not only find your book, but where they can go to get a hold of you should they need spiritual help, should they need a deliverance of their home, of their property, or of a family member.
Well, one website they can go to that I'm an affiliate with the Order of St. Michael the Archangel, Bishop Files organization. That's orderofexorcists.com. And they have exorcists and demonologists nationwide that are available to help folks. That's one. And two, I have a Facebook page, Paranormal Research Investigators of St. Michael. That's actually not a ghost hunting team. It's actually an exorcism team where we identify if it's legitimate or there's other things more explainable going on. The free service, you know, I never charge for one. I don't travel much these days, but if I do, it's usually I just ask for travel expenses and a couch or something to sleep on, and sure, I'm golden, you know, but I never charge, especially if it's local. Scripture tells me freely you've been given, freely give. And so I do. Right. And of course I have my Facebook page, just James Cloud, me sitting there with my current profile picture is just sunglasses and a hat. And I've almost met my max quote unquote friends. But I believe I transferred it to public page so they can, yeah, folks can find me on there. And of course, Amazon has my book. Oh my goodness. Just skip my brain.
And of course the Curious Realm store.
Yeah, there you go.
The Curious Realm store. Hashtag shameless plug.
Hey, that's okay. You go right there. Help this brother out.
Well, I mean, in all sincerity, it is amazing work that you do out there. I love keeping track of you on social media and seeing the deliverances that you're a part of. I mean, you don't post anything of them, but you do post about them, and you post about your needs for prayer for deliverance. And as we were saying, yeah, before the show began recording this evening, I am glad to see a lull in your need of prayer for deliverance.
Yeah.
I am very happy to see a lull in that, as I'm sure you are.
Oh, definitely. Definitely. I do a lot of teaching on my page, or I, you know, share stupid memes to make people laugh, but beyond
you
do
that,
I do. And they're really stupid sometimes.
But thank you so much for your time tonight. I greatly appreciate it. You have yourself a blessed All Hallows Eve and a blessed All Saints Day tomorrow.
I shall.
Do hold on to things while we close stuff out with our audience, while you are online checking out all of the amazing work of the Order of St. Michael the Archangel, as well as Father James Cloud. Make sure to stop on by curiousrealm.com/videos. That's where you can follow James Cloud on his YouTube. That is where you can find the store at curiousrealm.com/store. Thank you so much for tuning in, as always, everybody. It is your open hearts and open minds that make these conversations possible. And without these conversations, we stagnate as a humanity. So take care of yourselves, take care of each other, and remember, stay curious. We'll talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
Thank you for tuning into this episode of The Curious Realm. Stay tuned for more guests, forbidden topics, and hidden truths. Download the official Curious Realm app and view the knowledge vault on our website, curiousrealm.com. Follow us on social media by searching Curious Realm. Curious Realm is available on your favorite podcast services, as well as YouTube, Roku, Amazon Fire, and Apple TV through the APR TV app, available on all app markets. Curious Realm is a proud member of the HC Universal Network family of podcasts. For more great content or to become a sponsor of Curious Realm or other podcasts, visit hcuniversalnetwork.com today. Thanks for listening. Stay curious. And remember, the other side is always watching.